The Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee will come to order. Today we do have a full schedule, and we are having a full review of community-based wind development. Seabed is it's a concept that we have wanted to make work for Minnesota, for the small businesses, landowners in Minnesota, and I'm not certain that it ever has lived up to its potential. And so what we'd like to do is to get a review of what's going on and find out. We've tried numerous times to tweak the legislation to make it work. We're not giving up on it. We still want to. There is a proposal today that we have a chance to look at. And what we'd like to do is start with the department telling us, you know, how it's been working so far. So I'm going to call on Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner, Director of the State Energy Office. Mr. Glahn.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I am Bill Glahn, the Director of the Office of Energy Security and a Deputy Commissioner in the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And I was subbing for Mr. DeFebri, who is under the weather and was unable to make it today. So I will do my level best to fill in for him this afternoon. I have to say I was not around in this area and not around in this field in the time that the seabed statute came into law. So I would I've talked to Mr. DeFebri. I have some staff people here who could help out if my memory doesn't fill in all the gaps that we need to have filled in. And I'm sure that Mr. Bull, who's on the witness list later this afternoon, will correct any errors of fact or significant omissions I make this morning. So if it pleases the committee, I have a couple of introductory remarks regarding what's been done and what we see in terms of seabed development in the state. And I understand there are a number of questions that the committee have regarding how the program works and some of the specifics of the financing, et cetera, and I'd be happy to answer those following.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, it's my understanding the seabed statute was put in 2005. It's been altered two or three times since then, tweaked in various ways to try to make it more workable. It's taken a little bit of time to get the project off the ground, and again, people should be aware that there have been community energy developments before seabed, so and this is not a new concept, but the seabed tariff statute is fairly recent. And at least the way we count projects, and I had Mr. Seufert pass out, or somebody passed out to you, a list of the projects that are on our, I'll have to say, unofficial list of seabed projects. And you can see there's one project that actually dates from 2007, and we have had a number of projects that were put in place in 2008. A couple of the projects, a couple of the smaller projects, are actually projects undertaken by two electric co-ops. And I would point those out because they're not projects that our department had any role, official or unofficial, in the seabed process, but there's this mechanism called the Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System, which Minnesota and other states use to track the renewable energy credits associated with renewable energy. Part of it giving a place for people to register their credits. It's anticipated at some point in the future there'll be a trading mechanism that goes along with it. But mostly the purpose it serves to make sure that projects are counted only once, that somebody can't count a project toward meeting a renewable energy requirement in Minnesota and counting that same electricity toward a requirement in one of the neighboring states we have here. So those two projects, I bring them to your attention because they're co-op projects, and I guess I would characterize them as self-declared seabed projects. You know, in layman's reading of the statute, I don't see why they wouldn't qualify. But these other projects are projects in which, at some point, our office had some role in sending a letter or providing some documentation on behalf of the projects, And it's our understanding that all of these are up and running. They total around 120 megawatts, and 117 of which were put in 2008, which compares to about 430 megawatts of overall wind energy projects that were put in place in 2008. So a little over a quarter of all the projects in 2008 were seabed projects. But I would also point out that it's our understanding that there are about another 55 megawatts of wind projects that are under contract, and roughly half that amount have gone through the permitting process and are at some stage of finishing the development project and coming online. We have approximately 320 megawatts of seabed projects in the permitting process, at some stage of the permitting process, and there are a number of stages that the permitting process goes through, and approximately another 290 megawatts at some lesser stage of development that have not begun the permitting process. So by our count, we have something on the order of 630 megawatts of projects in development, and that does not include the 117 that are already up and running. And I want to take pains to say that we don't know that all 630 will ever be developed, or that should they be developed, they will be developed as seabed-eligible projects. They could take some different path to development than seabed. But I just want to give you a flavor for what we know of is out there in the universe. And so I know the program took a little bit of time to get going. It was a couple of years before the first project came in. We had quite a bit of activity last year. We're still hoping to have a few hundred megawatts here in the next couple of years. But again, as we discussed when we presented our report on renewable energy writ large, that some of these projects suffer from similar developmental hurdles, and I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about it from the witnesses on the bill, financing, transmission access, contracting issues, equipment availability issues, on and on and on. So that's my quick overview of what we're aware of is going on in the seabed world, and I understood that you had some specific questions regarding how the statute is operated and how these projects are structured.
Yes.
Did you want me to go through the?
Yeah, would you please?
Okay. All right, I'd be happy to. I didn't know how you wanted to proceed. So Mr. Seufert forwarded to my office a list of 10 questions, and I will endeavor to answer them as best I can about how the seabed law question, how the seabed statute works, and I brought the red book with me. And I see Mr. Fuller has the office copy or the rooms copy of the red book. The first question asks, and I'll paraphrase it here: have there been studies of local benefits from renewable energy development, and specifically, have there been studies that differentiate the benefits available depending on ownership structure, et cetera? And my answer to that is there have been studies that have been conducted. We're aware of a couple by the University of Minnesota Morris and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory that have been done on, again, writ large, local benefits of renewable energy, community energy development. However, we're not aware, and it might just be our not being aware of everything out there in the universe, we're not aware of studies that specifically looked at how different ownership structures produce different levels of benefits for the communities that hosted them and participate. So we haven't seen that granularity of the studies, but there have been studies that show local benefits, and I would speculate that's how a lot of this effort has gotten underway from some of these past studies and some of these past efforts at community energy development. So question two asks about qualifying owners under seabed law. And so, and I would call the committee's attention to 216B.16.12. Subdivision 2 has some definitions of what a qualifying owner is, and how you would organize the limited liability company, and what kind of entities could belong to such an LLC. And it seems pretty clear that for the qualifying owners, that they need to be Minnesota residents, Minnesota-based organizations of whatever type is allowed in the statute. So there is a requirement for the qualifying owners that they must be residents of Minnesota. As far as the size is concerned, again, this is just our understanding more of federal law, that if you get above a certain size, and it's our understanding it's 35 members of an LLC, an LLC being somewhat similar in structure to a partnership or an entity I'm more familiar with, an S corporation, in that it's a pass-through entity. The members show as income their share of whatever the entity produced in a given year, and taxation occurs at the member level rather than at the corporate level. So once you get above 35 members, then you start falling into categories where you might come under some Securities and Exchange Commission regulations. So we think it's unlikely that one of these things would be organized and end up with more larger than a 35-member entity. But that's just, I would characterize that as speculation on our part. I don't think we have any statistics on that.
What is the size of most of the seabed projects, or do you know what the range is?
In terms of the number of members in it, do we have any? We have the contracts for the ones who ask our participation in this, but I don't think we have. It goes down to the list of who members are. You know, there's the contract between the power purchaser and then the entity, and I don't think it has that level of detail in it.
So you don't know who the landowners in the project are?
Oh, we do have some of that information, but we haven't had the time to prepare any summary statistics for that purpose. So,
okay, maybe you could forward that to us.
We'd be happy to do so.
Could we back up to that first question?
Sure.
You said that there haven't been any thorough studies of the various models of integrating wind into the system from small projects. And I'm just wondering if the department is comfortable with the seabed model by virtue of the fact that you haven't studied the other models, or that there hasn't been a model that kind of rises to the top as being the one to follow.
I guess speaking for the department, I don't have a problem with the seabed model. Keep in mind, part of this is the first project only went online in mid-2007, so we don't have a project yet that's even 2 years down the 20-year range of these projects. So perhaps some of the witnesses that are going to speak to the bill could speak to more direct experience. But as far as I know, we're not aware of any big problems that have arisen as in terms of the ownership structure or the model itself. I know there's been a general frustration level at the pace of development, and we perceive the pace is picking up and will continue to pick up, notwithstanding the problems with the general economy and credit markets. But from our standpoint, we think the program is working, and as far as we know, is working well. That being said, you know, we're certainly open to talking with folks about how we can make common sense changes to broaden the participation of groups if their groups feel that they've been underrepresented.
But do you think that this seabed model is optimizing the local benefit?
That I can't say. I agree with you that I would really like to see a rigorous study where controlled, I don't know if we could conduct a controlled experiment, but rigorous analysis of actual results. Because we're not, other states have done community energy. I mean, we think we're at the forefront of it, but other states have done it, and it'd be interesting to have somebody do a compare and contrast, and you know, there's economists all over this country who have done studies of local benefits from stadiums being built and all kinds of other big public projects. So I'm sure that expertise is out there. I'm just not aware that it's been brought to bear on this particular issue.
Okay, how about number three then? That current law requires that 51% of the gross revenue from the power purchase agreement over the life of the seabed project must go to the qualifying owners and other local entities. And I'm just wondering if, in fact, that is occurring.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that in these PPAs, that's built in as provisions of the power purchase agreements, that these ownership or that my understanding of the PPAs require that the projects continue to meet the provisions of the law.
But how are you monitoring that?
We are not. Madam Chair, we are not monitoring. You know, it's early days yet. We are still at the position where these projects will be 95-99% owned by the equity partner or controlled by the equity partner, because we haven't got to the point where any of these projects have flipped, and the qualifying local owners have become majority owners, majority controllers of these projects.
So they're not collecting any of the benefit yet?
Oh, that's not to say that. We're aware of a number of these projects where I was speaking of the PPA. There's a separate agreement or set of agreements among the LLC partners that spells out who has how much of the economic benefits at what point in time and how that changes over time to accomplish the flip. And it's our understanding that a number of these projects, the local community owners were the ones who put up the funds for the early development efforts, and they may have received compensation for the money they put up in the first days of development, the paying for the transmission studies and the other permitting work, et cetera. So they may have already gotten some of their development cost out of the projects, or they may have, if they're also landowners, may have gotten lease payments for the wind rights, et cetera, et cetera. So beyond just the cents per kilowatt hour that gets paid to the project, there may we believe there are provisions in these agreements among the partners to have local owners benefit from collecting other monies up front or as these projects progress. So,
you mean just to cover their expenses?
The expenses they incurred in getting the project off the ground, or as any landowner would who had sold wind rights to a developer, or what other financial services and arrangements that they provided to the project.
And are there other models besides the flip model?
I would say the seabed, the flip model is I know I'd characterize it as pretty much written into the statute with the 51% requirement and the higher rate in the first 10 years and the way the equity owner and some of the provisions really point the way to the flip model. That's not to be said that there aren't other models where you have a single person who's the equity owner. That might just be a farmer or a landowner or a wealthy investor. The co-op model, I mentioned that before. I don't think that probably has – it would be my speculation that those projects don't have this flip model characteristic. The co-op model has the customers and owners are one and the same. Project owners, they'd all be the same entity. So there are other models of doing it.
Yeah, what I'm trying to understand is really how much local benefit is coming out of these.
And, Madam Chair, I have to say I've seen no rigorous study or no quantification, no roll-ups where I can say we've seen X million dollars of local benefit in year one and Y million dollars in year two. I think that would certainly be useful for the committee to have that kind of information. But
it seems to me there are a lot of upfront costs that in financing. Mm-hmm. Most of those financiers are not in the state of Minnesota, right?
Oh, no. I'm sure there's some, but I wouldn't be surprised to find that a lot of the financing for these projects, the equity financing, is from out of state. That would not surprise me.
Okay. So who is receiving the revenue from the projects?
Well, the flip model would have the equity owner, the equity partner, receiving the bulk of the financial benefits of the projects in the early years. And for all these projects, we're in the early years. And they typically anywhere from 90 to 95 to even as high as 99% of the benefit goes to the equity partner in the early years. It's true that the local partners may well have put up money for transmission studies and perhaps deposits down on equipment and good faith money for land rights, et cetera, but the equity partner would be my expectation would put up the bulk of the funds to buy the equipment and do the construction and everything else to get the project up and running. And the 20-year nature of the projects where you have one price for 10 years and a lower price for the second 10 years, and this 95% or whatever it is going down to zero over the 20 years is to allow that equity partner, who is more likely than not to be the only tax-paying entity or the big tax-paying entity in the deal, to take advantage of the production tax credits and the accelerated depreciation benefits that are available under law to renewable energy projects. So that really is the thinking behind the flip model, is let these folks who are putting up the bulk of the money get those depreciation benefits and those production tax credits, whereas a nonprofit or some other non-tax-paying entity would not be able to see the benefit of that.
But again, that's likely to be an out-of-state entity.
It could well be.
May not bring local benefit.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it could well be.
Okay. We've been trying to aggregate these seabed projects. Why?
This was before my time, but my understanding was that, and as made clear from the chart we handed out, many of these projects are small, you know, a couple of megawatts to, you know, 10, 20 megawatts, and the wind development business is one I think that can be fairly characterized as benefiting from economies of scale, which is why you see projects that are 100 or 200, even larger megawatt projects, where you can mobilize a crew and do a lot and drive down the per unit cost of the construction cost, volume discounts for equipment buying. I've never done this myself, but this would be hearsay, but it's been my understanding that some of these equipment vendors won't even deal with the little guys, that they want big orders where somebody's ordering dozens and dozens of turbines at a time. And so the thought was that perhaps we could look into aggregating these projects, so a bunch of these smaller seabed projects would look to an equipment vendor or look to a financier as a big utility-scale wind farm project. To my knowledge, we haven't done that. We haven't been able to take advantage of the aggregation. Still something that we're looking at and we'll continue to look at. But the thought is that there are economies of scale. It's tough to do these in onesies and twosies, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that from the witnesses to the bill. So we were looking at ways we could aggregate either specifically the equipment purchases, and MISO already does some aggregation of smaller projects for the purposes of conducting transmission studies to try to bring together groups and share the cost among a larger pool instead of having each individual project pay a full boat cost of a full-blown transmission study. So there have been some efforts like that in MISO studies. We've looked at the equipment aggregation and looked at aggregation more generally and have to date not accomplished it.
How about each utility is supposed to file a seabed tariff? Have they done so?
It's my understanding from consulting with my staff that all utilities that are subject to the statute have indeed filed tariffs with the Public Utilities Commission. I do not know if there is anybody at the hearing here from the Public Utilities Commission to confirm that, but that's our understanding.
And what does that tariff provide?
It provides for the terms that are in the statute, that, you know, that there's a higher rate paid for the first 10 years and that it uses this net present value mechanism and, you know, has all the requirements that are listed in 1612. I guess I would add, Madam Chair, I do not believe pricing is part of the tariff. There is no pricing except for the structure of pricing. There are no actual dollar amounts included in these tariffs.
Okay. Are there other types of community projects out there besides the seabed projects that have been developed?
Madam Chair, that is our understanding that prior to the seabed, and I did not bring a sheet that lists projects and totals up to a number, but we thought it was something on the order of about 200 megawatts of what we would describe as community projects. Now, maybe not everyone would agree on our definition of what community included, but approximately 200 megawatts of what we would call community projects, perhaps not meeting the definition of seabed, but that had been accomplished in the 15 years or so that we've been doing or had our latest phase of large-scale wind power development.
Okay. And then seabed law allows the developers, the seabed developers, to partner with the utilities. Has that occurred, and how is that working?
Except for the two that I listed on the sheet as being cooperatives, those are the two that we are familiar with that are
okay.
We have utilities involved as project folks. Now, of course, all these projects sell to utilities. The output is sold to utilities. So that's listed in that penultimate column there on the right, mm-hmm. MinPower, Missouri River, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say when using the word involved, those are the utilities listed in that sheet have been involved, but only the co-ops would I qualify as being participants in the project.
Thinking back on those other local projects that aren't seabed projects, how did they compare to the seabed projects in providing local benefit?
We, Madam Chair, once again, we have not done a compare and contrast of that.
Okay. Have you any advice?
Any advice? I guess I would say, as general advice, I think it's been clear from our discussion here this afternoon that while we're very, the department, we think the administration has been very supportive of seabed, and we believe seabed is succeeding and will continue to succeed. The tracking of this has been.
What is it that leads you to believe it's succeeding?
Well, the 120 megawatts that we have online today. That's my definition of success. Now I understand that.
And do those meet the statute requirements?
Again, not being an attorney, but from my layman's reading of it, I would say yes. But again, the department, there is no certification process for projects either us or the PUC, and that might be advice I would have going forward is to have a more tracking of the projects and tighter definitions of them in terms of who is officially and who is unofficially a project. That, I guess that might be my advice going forward, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I think I'm particularly interested in the local benefit in terms of whether these seabed projects are really meeting the local benefit. I felt that was, the legislature's mission or the charge also is to establish as much local benefit as possible from these seabed projects.
Madam Chair, again, perhaps some of the other witnesses today will speak to that. We will go back to our office, cast a wider net to see if we can find studies. We did a search in the day or so since we started looking at these questions, but we can certainly cast a wider net and look not just to other states, but there have been other models used in other countries, particularly in Europe. We could take a look at that. Perhaps the EU has done some studies along these lines, and we'll overturn every rock we can find, and if not, we may well come back to you with a proposal on how we can look into it ourselves.
Well, we'd look forward to that. Let me go back to the 630 megawatts you said are in the works, and that's apart from the 119 that are already operating?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And have they been there for a while, or are they just... Are they just inquiries? Are they projects that are in the queue or are working on contracts? Or,
Madam Chair, I'd characterize them as all of the above. We have 55 megawatts we believe are under contract, and of that, roughly half have completed their permitting, so we would hope that those would be real projects that would be up and running in the near future. The ones that are in the permitting, you don't undertake that effort lightly, so I would characterize those as real projects. The 290 I listed as being in some other phase, I have less. That could just be somebody's grand idea, and perhaps they'll come to something, perhaps not. So that's why I broke it down by those. I feel confident about the 55 megawatts or have a degree of confidence. 320, I don't know how much of that's going to happen, but I would hope that a lot of that would end up getting built and built soon, and we'll... The 290, I guess I'll put it in the category. We'll see how that develops.
And we've heard some horror stories about some landowners who have put up significant amounts of money, think that they're ready to progress, and then they've been required in order to move forward to put up again, and I'm pulling this out of the air, but I think it was like $50,000 a piece again to move forward. Are those... projects that have come to your attention, and are those projects that have been able to be resolved so they don't lose their investment and they can move forward?
Madam Chair, I have had those sort of horror stories brought to my attention. Developers contacting my office directly or the commissioner directly. There is one project, I don't know if it's the one you're speaking of, a project out in the western part of the state where they had gone quite a bit of ways downrange developing a project only to hit the MISO hurdle and being told that they had to go and I, you know, I don't know how many members were involved, but a couple of $100,000 of additional funds into studying the MISO transmission availability for the project and with no guarantee that the answer is going to be favorable. And from my layman's knowledge of where the project was located, I wouldn't be giving them any hope that they're going to get a good result from that study. So I hear these stories, and the MISO transmission, and that was one of the things that Ms. White talked about in presenting our report on the larger renewable energy development of the state, that transmission availability is a real and very significant issue for projects interconnecting. One of the reasons why we have undertaken the study for the distributed renewable energy, the sweet spot study. I had a gentleman come up to me a couple of days ago saying that he was one of those folks who put in to the MISO queue for 40 megawatts at one of those spots we identified. Hopefully that'll provide some relief to the folks out there, but I'm sure there's more than one horror story out there, and there are lots of projects that have hit roadblocks. I do not know what the resolution of that particular one was with the MISO transmission cost. We believe the MISO transmission queue reform process, which is only been lately accomplished, will go a long way to getting some of the projects that are ready to go up and at them. And then the projects and prioritizing those that have the financing, have the equipment lined up and everything, they should be ready to go. And hopefully in short order. And I had the opportunity to go and tour MISO's St. Paul headquarters here fairly recently with some of the members of the other body that's parallel to this one. And we were told that if a new project came along and there was transmission available, that MISO could turn a study around in as little as 12 months. So perhaps progress is being made, but I have no doubt that there are a number of projects out there that have hit roadblocks and have not overcome that. And again, I'd encourage people to come up with to me, and I know I've done a little bit of troubleshooting as barriers come to my attention, and I'd be happy to use whatever my good offices could offer to help projects along.
Okay. Are there questions by the members? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on a couple of things you'd been discussing. And on this last line, we were talking about some of the complaints. And do we know kind of what the general satisfaction is of the ongoing projects? Are they satisfied with where they are? We don't know what the return is. I think we're not that far enough into it as far as dollars maybe, but just the general satisfaction of those that are up and running of that 120 megawatts.
Perhaps I'll be, Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, perhaps I'll be proven wrong here in the next hour or so, but, you know, I haven't had anything brought to my attention from existing projects. Now, there have been, of the ones on that list, I can tell you there are at least a number that large where our office has been involved at some stage of the process in giving advice or helping to make connections where success wasn't achieved. So of the ones that are up and running, I haven't heard any bad feedback or horror stories. I would say it's early days yet, but there are lots of would-be projects out there that haven't gotten that far.
Okay. Madam Chair, Commissioner Glahn, the model, the flip model, and, you know, you said 90 to 95% of the benefit goes to that equity owner in the early years, and yet there's a certain amount of investment that the other parties put into this. As far as cost recovery, do they have to wait, the other owners there, or do you know generally on the contracts that are out there, how that's done? Is there is most of that recovery being done by the equity owners, or how is that playing out?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I would say that the provisions of many of the provisions of these contracts are considered trade secret, and I was trying to be a little vague with the percentages, so I'm not giving away numbers, but I'd characterize it as common that the people who made upfront investments to get the project going recover those investments, and as part and in the early part of the projects, and then really don't see the benefits of it until the equity partner has been able to get the benefits from the production tax credit and the accelerated depreciation. So I'd characterize it as they get their upfront costs recovered up front, but they really don't start seeing the return until some years in the future.
Deputy Commissioner, don't you have to approve these contracts?
Madam Chair, no, we do not.
You don't?
Madam Chair, we do not. We examine them to see that they're compliant with the law, but the terms are...
How do you know that they're getting 51% then?
Well, based on the... Madam Chair, based on the pro forma cash flows and the spreadsheet showing, here's how it's going to work, and here's year one, year two, through year 20, and adding the numbers together, making sure it's 51%. So from that respect, that we do due diligence to make sure that it's meeting the letter of the law, but we don't go and make sure that after the third month they actually got what the pro forma said they were going to get. We do not do that level of auditing.
And so there's no reporting back after the contract is approved?
Madam Chair, we approve the PPA as being compliant with the statute, but we do not approve those membership agreements, those LLC agreements. So I'm sorry if I confuse folks. They're two different sets of agreements here.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner, then, in this plan, though, what I'm seeing is that at the flip model, they basically expired all the tax credits and everything else. There's nothing left for the other local owners then as far as additional benefits beyond the, after the 10 years. They basically are just getting whatever the cost of the electricity is generated. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I would characterize it as the first 10 years, notwithstanding the repayment of whatever upfront costs folks might have had, those monies go by and large to the equity holder. And then after 10 years, the monies start flowing to the qualifying owners. At the end of the project, the qualifying owners are the residual owner of it, by and large.
Okay. And just a couple other quick things, if I might, Madam Chair, is that in the projects, Deputy Commissioner, there's when I looked at this list before of who's doing partnering in state anyway, there's only a couple of utilities that are doing that with for the bulk of this 120 or even the 635 megawatts. Does that mean that the rest of the things that are going on are coming from outside of the state in terms of the partnerships, the equity investors?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, other than stating just my layman's belief that this is probably true, a lot of these folks are out of state, I really don't have the data to say with any degree of certainty. So I'll defer any more specific answer to your question pending further investigation of that question.
Senator Beshear.
Well, probably just back to asking the same question that others are asking. If I understand correctly, the law requires that 50% of the gross revenue from power purchase agreement over the life must go to qualifying owners. You're saying to me that the law says that, but we do not have in the law a method by which we account for whether or not that in fact happens, and we don't have a penalty or any consequence if that does not happen. Is that what I understand you're saying?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I guess I would split your question into two parts. The answer to the first part is that we don't have any mechanism for doing a look back over the 20 years to see, at least not as of yet, to see if indeed what was projected in those cash flow pro formas turned out to be true. The second part, I would, again, the PPAs, my understanding, have provisions saying the project has to continue to be compliant with the statute. So if at some point in the future, for example, if the qualifying owners are prohibited from selling out to non-qualifying owners because they would be in violation of this. So the PPA is a mechanism for enforcement as well. So just with that qualification, that's my answer to your question.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you.
I think we'll need to talk further and figure out how we can track these a little bit better. And
Madam Chair, I would agree that this seemed to be a recurring theme this afternoon.
Okay.
And it's and something we'll no doubt be reporting back to you on our progress.
Senator Rosen has a question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Glomp, can you explain why it is important to track this, though? I'm still a little confused why we have to track that at that certain.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I would agree with Madam Chair that the whole purpose behind the seabed statute was to ensure to some degree that local communities were benefiting from hosting these facilities, which not all communities are so enamored of. And so landowners, property owners, citizens, the idea was to give them a mechanism that they could participate in a meaningful way in the renewable energy mandates and renewable energy development that the state's undergoing. So to the extent that we had a public purpose underlying the creation of the seabed concept, it seems to be a fair inference that we should be doing some due diligence to see whether or not that public purpose is being served.
Thank you. We will now move on to Senate File 399, Senator Gary Kubley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Senate File 399, I guess from my perspective, and there are a lot of people here, some in favor of the bill and some not, you know, so I don't want to take a lot of time talking about it. But I guess from my perspective, I think that it hasn't worked terribly well keeping the dollars locally so far. And this bill is an attempt to keep those dollars in local communities. And I think as you listen to the testimony, Madam Chair and members, you'll discover that there are significant dollars that turn over in rural communities. And I think this would be a very positive economic stimulus bill of our own for the rural parts of the state. I realize that the metropolitan parts probably would not benefit in the same way, but I think that when you look at the number of times a dollar turns over in a community where it's generated when the local ownership is already living there, you know, it's a fairly substantial amount of turnover in those dollars that really adds to local economies and the viability of the rural parts of the state as a whole. I think, you know, I'd ask the first couple of testifiers to move up to the table, Madam Chair, and I think we can listen to the testimony. With all due respect to Commissioner Glahn, I think he's not entirely accurate in the information that he was relaying, and maybe the testifiers will be offering some correction to that as well. But I think I'd ask the first two testifiers to come forward at this time, Madam Chair.
Senator Kubley, who's going to walk through your bill and tell us how you're planning on doing this?
Are you going to do that, or do you want me to do it? Well, Madam Chair, I guess I assumed that some of those things would be done by the testifiers, but, you know, it does establish a market-based tariff. And I think that is one of the areas that is objected to, certainly by those who would be asked to purchase it.
Senator Kubley, I'm aware you're probably working off your delete all amendment.
I am, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. We'll back up and take a look at the A2 amendment. I think there were a couple of drafts
Senator
of that.
Senator Dibble moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I should have caught that at the beginning. But anyway, the whole tariff idea, does allow small producers to take part in the process. You know, I know that... From those who object that they'll give you their reasons, but the presence of that market-based tariff, in my opinion, allows smaller generators to take part in a way that would be quite beneficial to the rural areas where those people live. There are, you know, there are some pieces that talk about how much each of the people involved in one of these smaller seabed projects could own. I think as you distribute the income across across the landscape of the rural parts of the state, that those smaller parts being spread out, I think that helps to offer some insurance that that those dollars will in fact turn over in those local communities. There are really quite a few pieces, Madam Chair and members, but this is this bill is looking primarily at the smaller projects that are 5 megawatts or less. It does have some insurance there also that they would be able to maintain the projects and that a single owner would not be able to have more than the 15%.
What section are you in, Senator?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to give you a thumbnail sketch and reserve more of the time for the testifiers. So, you know, I'm on section 4, you know, and I've moved around between paragraphs E and H. But that is on your handout, too, Madam Chair. So, I think, you know, and I'm not sure, and maybe one of the testifiers can respond to the 5-mile radius. I'm just not, you know, I do think that there is value in spreading the ownership across a wider population base than what might otherwise be possible if you allowed a few people to own a larger percentage. You know, those are, you know, my understandings of it. I guess, you know, if there are specific questions, Madam Chair, I guess I would just as soon address those rather than spending my time at it as well, but I think, you know, with the number of...
I just wanted you to tell us what your bill does so that we know what we're approving here.
Well, basically, Madam Chair, you know, the bill, I thought I already stated that. It allows, you know, for local ownership. You know, most of the projects that are out there are owned by companies that are either not in the state or even not in the country. I think, you know, as you look at who owns the majority of the projects that are out there, you know, you see most of the money leaving the state and a significant portion of it even leaving the country. You know, it's the intent of this bill to try and keep that money in Minnesota and, in fact, in local communities where it seems to me it would do far and away the most good in terms of keeping rural areas economically viable. You know, local ownership, whether it be farm ownership or a project like this, I think whenever you have local ownership, you know, the studies that are out there indicate that we're much better off to have that local ownership and keep those dollars local. Okay. Arne Kildegard at the University of Minnesota at Morris has done a study that talks about that very issue. And even though I think Dr. Kildegard's study is fairly conservative in terms of the numbers it used, it does show the significant benefit to rural communities if they're able to keep those dollars there.
Okay. Mr. Jewell, are you the first speaker?
Madam Chairman, I believe I am.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dan Jewell. I'm CEO of Jewell Wind, a seabed developer, and also on the steering committee of Seabed Initiative, which is a nonprofit that helps communities get involved. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate File 399, as we believe that this bill will help all community-based projects move ahead in a fair fashion. The first part of the bill basically addresses a standardized contract provision for projects that are over 5 megawatts in size. And that provision was basically put in because the projects that are out there now, the seabed developers.
Mr. Jewell, move the microphone just a little closer. We don't want to miss what you're saying.
Is it on?
That's better.
Yep. Okay. Sorry about that, Madam Chair.
Okay. The
Senator Rosen, just a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we working off the A2 amendment or the original bill?
The A2 amendment. Okay. Okay, Mr. Jewell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the part of the bill that has projects over 5 megawatts is we're looking at putting in place a standardized contract provision that allows seabed projects, when they go through the request for proposal process from the utilities and they win a bid, the power contract that you sign will be basically predetermined through a standardized contract. And that allows the project to move ahead quickly and get the project in the ground. Part of the reason why we have this fluctuation where some seabed projects are trying to move ahead and they can't get very far is because we run into the problem of once you win the bid, you have to try to negotiate a contract, provisions of the contract, which usually takes quite a while. And it's nobody's fault. It's not the utility's fault. It's not necessarily the developer's fault. It's mainly the fact that there's a lot of lawyers that get involved. And if we have a standardized contract, that would make the process go much smoother and would help seabed projects in general move ahead, the ones that are put out for bids by the utilities and responded to by the developers. The second provision in the bill is basically for 5-megawatt projects and below. And this provision is basically targeted for small communities out throughout rural Minnesota that want to participate. They're rural economic development authorities, cities themselves, small business people and farmers that live out there that want to participate in Minnesota's renewable energy mandate but just don't have the capacity to go in and get into the bidding process and go through all of the rigmarole that it takes to get a project developed on a larger scale. And so to help that through, we've asked that we look at some sort of a tariff rate be put into 5-megawatt and below standardized contracts to make the process simple for the communities. And we've based that rate on a formula, which is the seabed formula that is in statute already, or the front-loaded net present value formula. And the target price for that is last year's Minnesota hub of the MISO average. And so that's basically the all-in price from the MISO's last year day-ahead average. And that's a number that we can get from the MISO. They issue a report on an annual basis that gives that number as a solid number. And we feel that that's a fair number because these projects are 20-year projects, and the power contracts are for 20 years. And if we base that 20-year contract on last year's average price, that would be a fair mechanism. And that will allow them.
Why do you say that's fair? I mean, what makes that fair?
Well, because, Madam Chairman, the price is based on last year's average price, net present valued over 20 years. It's a number. We've struggled to try to come up with how to make a pricing mechanism for a small project like this work. And that's the mechanism we came up with, was using last year's average price as the benchmark for the net present value number.
But aren't we, in effect, using a federal price mechanism that the state has no control over to set the price then?
Madam Chairman, that's the average price on the Minnesota hub that we pay for our energy. That's our average price that we pay in Minnesota for the energy on the system. The MISO runs the system as a whole, and that price that we're targeting is Minnesota's last year's average price for this market.
You mean Minnesota's average price for whom?
For the utilities, for the MISO price.
That's the average price that they're paying to buy electricity off of the...
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Is it the average price that's set for long-term contracts?
No, that's the average price of last year's. That's last year's average. And that's why we want to use that as because the seabed contract is a 20-year contract. That is a long-term contract. And you have to look at that in a net present value form to give a true fair value to that contract. And so using last year's price as the target price was what we thought would be a fair and equitable price. And again, Madam Chairman, these contracts are front-loaded, they're flat, and then after 10 years, they drop down and they go like this. And so it guarantees our ratepayers long-term low-cost energy where all other contracts mainly go like this. And so, you know, doing a flat rate 20-year net present value contract is good for us consumers. And if it brings us a whole bunch of economic development in the front years, that's a very big value.
See, what we're still trying to figure out is whether or not there's a fair return for the local owner. Because while there's a higher, while it's higher at the top end, there are a lot of expenses to pay off. And we're just not clear where that leaves the local owner.
Well, Madam Chairman, that's why...
And that guarantees that the investor is paid off, that the financier is paid off, that the developers are paid off, that
the expenses,
the equipment is paid off, yes.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, but in this case, you know, that what we talked about before on the FLIPS models that we talked about previously, these types of projects, because they can move fairly quickly in the system, will not use that same model, I don't think, because under the new stimulus package, there's a grant provision. So a small community could go in, apply for that grant, and use that as the front-end equity, and then use local bank debt financing for the balance, which would create value to the local banks in our communities. And so it's not going to be the same model that you see with the regular seabed, the bigger seabed projects that require an outside equity investor to come in and utilize the tax incentives. The grant, the stimulus package grants, will eliminate that. And basically this provision would bring over $100 million in federal stimulus dollars into our state through that mechanism.
Does this require the utility to pay more than market price for this 20-year fixed rate?
Madam Chairman, over the life of the contract, I think it's pretty much the same as they're paying everybody else. It's just structured a little bit different because the front end is a little bit higher because the project needs to debt service its capital. It needs to pay the bank back. And then that's why after 10 years, it can drop the price, because once you service the debt, the cost of wind energy is the cost of capital to service the debt. And once you do that, you can drop the price, and hence we have low-cost long-term energy out of these projects for our communities.
Okay. Did you have further comments?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Any questions of the speaker? John Ely?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Committee. My name is John Ely, and I'm a developer and founder of Community-Based Energy Developments. One of the projects I've been working on since 2003, the Glacial Ridge Wind Project, is a 20-megawatt seabed located in southeast Pope County. 3 years ago, we had made Xcel's shortlist on a request for proposals placed at that time by Xcel. And it took us 14 months to go through the negotiation process. And at the end of that process, essentially, turbine prices had changed and different things. The cost of the project had risen, and Xcel wasn't really interested in renegotiating that PPA. It's just a terribly long process, and because PPAs are within the sole control and domain of utilities, that having a standardized process and some sort of time frame in which these projects can be built is it's critical to the success of seabed. Seabed really has had a hard time getting going in the state, and I think the reason is because of timely and financeable PPAs. And right now, because of the economic stimulus, there's a really good opportunity, I think, to get things going respective of seabed. You've asked a lot of questions about finance and where these benefits, economic benefits, go. And, you know, I think for me, you know, it's kind of a, it's been a long process since to get to where we are today, where four or five years ago, when the days of the REPI projects were going on, there were only one or two finance entities out there, Edison Capital and John Deere, that were even willing to finance these kinds of projects. And, I think in spite of the economic slowdown right now, I think there's real opportunity through, like what was mentioned, the cash grants and relatively speaking, low-interest loans, much lower than what we've been paying, on debt thus far. And so finance has been kind of an issue in the past. I don't think it's going to be as big of an issue with financeable PPAs. One of the other issues, I think, with CBED, at least from my perspective, is that these projects the finance entities that are willing to finance these kinds of projects have had turbine allocations, and they basically cherry pick. So if you don't have all the T's crossed and the I's dotted on your project, and if you're financing, your pricing isn't comparable to other parts of the country. They essentially cherry pick and they decide to, send their turbines over to these other projects. And that's been a kind of an issue, I think, with some of the projects that I've become aware of in the state of Minnesota, seabed projects. My company and some of the projects that I'm working with, we are aggregating projects. We've aggregated approximately 165 megawatts of seabed projects and are working very closely together and do have turbine allocations, working with a world-class turbine manufacturer that has indicated that they, can deliver, those turbines in the next couple of years if we meet their terms and conditions. And one of the terms and conditions is a PPA that is financeable. And if you just simply can't it's one thing to get a PPA and go through the negotiation process with, like what we did for 14 months with Xcel. And I'm not really picking on Xcel. Really, it was what it was. And but at the end of the day, you really need numbers that support the capital costs that are being put up by these big finance entities. And the LMP market utilizing last year's average, I think, in incorporating the net present value and all that stuff over a 20-year period really does accomplish that. 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when REPI was so popular and, the state of Minnesota was paying a penny and a half a kilowatt hour on top of Xcel Energy's standard tariff rate for small projects, which at that time I think was 3.3 cents, bringing to the total 4 or 5 years ago 4.8 cents a kilowatt hour, that the capital costs have essentially doubled, since that time. You need approximately eight and a half cents, depending upon where you're located, for a project. So, just on the surface, I think, we're talking, the LMP pricing structure wouldn't be, unreasonable. There's just a lot of jobs that are created by. I had a whole great big long, thing to read you, and I don't really want to read it because I'd rather have time to answer some questions or,
Well, then I have some questions. We probably should have asked the deputy commissioner this question, but perhaps you can answer it too, because you've mentioned the production tax and the cash grants and the economic stimulus package. Can you tell us about that? What is it that you know about them, or what is available?
Well, I know a little bit about it. I've gotten a summary from our attorney, and one of the things that we're interested in for our projects are, is that 30% grant that the federal government is going to be implementing. They've signed it into law. The other thing is, and it hasn't really...
30% of the package grant of the cost of the project?
30% of the equipment costs, which are the prime... you know, I believe it's the equipment costs and not the construction of the project, but the capital costs, which, you know, are for, which is the biggest. It's like 80% of the project or thereabouts. So that's
about
one...
How large is something like that?
Oh, well, like the 20-megawatt project, we're talking probably close to 24 to 26 million bucks or something like that. It just depends on the exchange rate and things like that.
26 million would be the cost of the project or the capital the equipment or the 30%?
Just the turbines. And then 30% of that, you know, would be, you'd be able to get a cash grant for.
About $8.5 million.
Yeah, and then, you know, there are, and the federal government is working on this right now. There's a kind of a federal bank, I guess, if you will, that are going to be offering federally guaranteed loans at 3% interest rates. You don't need, you need an equity partner, perhaps, you know, to participate, and a utility would be excellent, in that respect, in my opinion, it would be. But, you know, equity partners can come from just about anywhere. And we've talked to different, interested financing parties. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of those interested people aren't located in Minnesota, like 3M. You know, I mean, I don't think 3M is.
You also mentioned that you have aggregated a number of projects. Can you then talk to section, on page 3.20, probably to 3.28? Because it seems like a disincentive to aggregate.
Well, yeah, and the projects that I am involved with at this time, this 5-megawatt in Blow, I think it's a great, great law. We had a lot of discussion in our seabed group about this. Why wouldn't some of these other projects, be able to participate in this same pricing mechanism? And the reasoning was that, the legislature quite simply wouldn't go for it. You know, at least that was my understanding at the time. But
that's not the reason.
But we have aggregated our projects were started in 2003, 2004-05. You know, they've been in, like many projects in the MISO queue and in the queue have been in, you know, in the development process for a long time. And
we've always believed that aggregating cuts costs and
it's for easier transmission
and
well, not so much transmission. Necessarily, I don't think, because the transmission costs are borne on a project-by-project basis. It's the construction of these types of projects, the economies of scale on the turbines and things of that nature that you can, and the operations and maintenance of these turbines if you're choosing turbines with the same manufacturer.
Perhaps I meant building into the transmission lines. Mr. Jewell.
Madam Chairman, the aggregation language in this bill is basically put in there to prevent gaming the system, because this was designed to help small communities throughout the state of Minnesota put together projects that will help their local economies, and we did not want to have people coming in and saying, well, I'm going to put 5 megawatts here and 5 megawatts here and 5 megawatts there and still call them individual projects. And so we had to figure out some sort of mechanism that would prevent the gaming of the system, because we want this stuff to be spread out throughout the state of Minnesota, throughout rural Minnesota, and give a lot of people the opportunity to own wind power in the state. And we had to try to figure out some way to stop or try to stop the gaming of the system, because it's been done before. Madam Chair,
yes, Mr.
Just to give you a quick, the federal stimulus package basically extended the federal production tax credit for 3 years until 2012. It created a 30% investment tax credit in lieu of the production tax credit. And then it also had a 30% grant for qualifying entities to participate in lieu of the tax credit, the federal tax credit, and also did a loan guarantee.
So do you
basically
think
the provisions.
Does the FLIP model still fit for this type of a model then, when there isn't that high financing at
Madam
the
Chair,
front end?
It does. It's, I mean, the grant process, basically there's an analysis that's been done. If you're over a certain capacity factor, which is right around 37% capacity factor, then the project would be better off to utilize the tax credits because you produce much more energy and it's a higher value. If you're under that, you might be better off to use the 30% grant for the equipment, and that's all weighed out according to your costs and your site and how much wind you have. And so it's designed to try to help different areas use the federal credits, because the credits are virtually, as they stood before, were almost impossible for us to use as regular citizens, and that's why the FLIP model was even developed.
I'd like to just want the gentleman from the Department of Commerce all seabed projects that I am aware of have a revenue sharing aspect to them, up until the FLIP, as well as paying back the monies for the capital costs, the interest rates, and stuff like that. There is another component on there that's sharing revenues with the communities.
Are there any questions of the speakers? And then we need to hear from people that wish to speak on the bill. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A couple of questions I wanted to ask. First off, the idea here is to generate more small seabed projects, correct? And is there any concern that, this is really going to drive the rates up for customers, and is it going to jeopardize the reliability of the electricity that we're producing to the utility customers?
Would like to take that, Mr. Jewell.
Madam Chairman, Senator Dahl, the price that's in there is a little bit higher. But if you take in, there's been an analysis done of that rate, and if you look at it over the life of the contract, it is not higher in its net present value form, and it's needed to be a little bit higher just to make these independent little small projects work financially, and it does not interfere with the reliability of the system. In fact, distributive generation is better for the system because you're not trying to force a lot of power into one spot. You're kind of blending into the system, And so there is no reliability issue at all with it, but the tariff rate that's in this bill is a little bit higher in the front years, but in the back years it's cheaper. And over the life of the project, it's a better deal for us ratepayers.
Okay, so Madam Chair and
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Jewell, that's so over time we'll see that's not having an effect, but in the short term it will push up at least what the utilities have to purchase it for, so it could have an effect on our ratepayers in the short term. Is that correct?
Mr. Joe.
Madam Chairman, Senator Dole, yes, that is correct. And the analysis has been that it's going to cost the average ratepayer about 19 cents a month or about a half a Big Mac a year.
Okay. Madam Chair, the other question I had, if I may, is on the preemption, I guess, federal rules and things. You must be talking with legal counsel on these things. Is the size of the project going to make a difference, in terms of the preemption rules with whether or not they have to set their rates, utilities, and purchase from you in this type of way?
I'm sorry.
Like right now we have with a 40-megawatt rule with net metering, I believe. And so I don't know if there's an issue with any federal regulations there, because we kept it under that 40 megawatts, and this is at 5 megawatts and below.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl,
Senator
that's 40
Kubler.
Kilowatts.
Kilowatts? Okay. And this
megawatts.
Is 5 megawatts, excuse me, but I...
No, it's 40 kilowatts that the net metering rule applies
okay.
to.
Now, in this one, it's 5 megawatts, each project. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious if there's an issue with the federal regulations and if the size of the project makes a difference.
Mr. Joe.
Madam Chairman, Senator Dahl, no, it's the 5 megawatts was basically chosen because Most of the big players won't mess with 5 megawatts and try to come in and abscond with the tariff rate. If in the state laws, if you're under 5 megawatts, you have different permitting provisions. And also in under the MISO rules, if you're under a certain of a size of 6 megawatts, then you can have a lower cost of entry into the MISO study process. And so the whole thing is designed to help small communities get into the process of owning wind generation without having all of the other hoops that we normally have to run through in the bigger projects.
Okay. One final question, Madam Chair. Thank you. We heard earlier that there's, you know, an issue where purchasing wind turbines and things like that, that usually the manufacturers or producers are looking at the larger orders, and that in an attempt to aggregate some of these smaller projects to make those purchases, and it's kind of been stumbling along a little bit, the progress on that. How are we going to address this if this were in play, to be doing individual projects to be able to actually supply these turbines to individuals, you know, basically be buying one or two at a time?
Mr. Joe?
Madam Chairman, Senator Dahl, that issue is not as bad as it used to be. When the turbine glut became a big issue a few years ago, a lot of manufacturers looked to manufacturing into the U.S., and they're coming into the U.S. Several of them are building factories here. There's more companies that have came into the market. The Europeans and some of the Asian companies are coming in, and some of them are building factories in the United States. And so that issue is not as bad as it used to be, and some manufacturers are actually targeting smaller community-based projects with technology that's more applicable to smaller projects, like machines in the 1 megawatt class. And most of the bottleneck before was because the big manufacturers were building great big wind turbines, and the specialized parts for those were hard to get. And so it's all changed.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Joel, you said that the average increase per ratepayer would be 19 cents. What assumptions did you use in order to arrive at that conclusion?
Madam Chairman, I think the Institute of Local Self-Reliance looked at that and came up with a calculation on what it would be. And they basically looked at the differential in price amortized over the system, Minnesota's rate-based system, using an average consumer of like 750 kilowatt hours a month. They had a formula that they used based on their knowledge of the total system.
But how many kilowatts or how many megawatts of seabed are you talking about in order to arrive at that?
And
which population are you drawing that from? The whole state of Minnesota or each utility's territory, or
Madam Chairman, that was derived over the whole system. We looked at about 15,000 megawatts of the whole system, and then the 200 megawatts that's in this bill, and the differential in the price amortized over the whole system would have that impact on the average ratepayer. And we have to add that half a Big Mac or that $2 a year is only for the first couple of years, because then after that, you basically get your Big Macs for free, because the price actually goes down over time.
Okay, now we've already reached 119 megawatts, and we're hearing there's 630 megawatts in the system. So how would that affect your bill?
Madam Chair, I don't believe it does. I mean, the provisions that what we're talking about is the bid projects, mainly when the utilities put out requests for proposals for bids for bigger projects, and those are all, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 megawatt projects. And this bill, mainly the part for the provision of the tariff is only for 200 megawatts out of the whole 15,000 megawatts of our system. Has basically, why don't we take a look at seeing if we can provide a vehicle for communities to get involved, use this as an economic development tool, and keep our energy dollars in our community. So all of the other seabed projects that are out there are not really affected by this bill, other than if we do a standardized contract for those where we can make them move smoother.
So this is 200 new megawatts. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chairman, I believe it's 200 megawatts of, it would be new because they're not built yet.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to comment on Senator Dahl's question about the back order of the turbines. And Mr. Jewell was correct. Most of those manufacturers have now located in Iowa. So there's, that's the problem. I was just going to mention that.
Senator Sharon.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, part of the reason, I think,
Senator
is because
Coogley.
Iowa has a couple of people going to bat for them overseas where the manufacturers already exist and asking them to come to Iowa. You know, it would seem to me like that might be a good idea for Minnesota.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Senator Sharon.
I'm looking at the section of the bill, the A2 amendment, that looks at priority for seabed projects. I haven't heard you talking about that, and I'm trying to get to comprehend what is being expected here of the utilities and how that's different from the original seabed language.
Where are you looking, Senator Sharon?
On the A2,
Section 3, Subdivision 5,
that refers to utilities subject that need to construct new generation or purchase the output.
Which lines are you looking at?
It starts with 1.29 and proceeds in its total discussion through 2.15,
okay,
and addresses an issue that I think, if I understand what I'm reading here correctly, requires utilities to, before they can expand their construction of their new generation or purchase output from new generation, they have to purchase, I can't tell here if it's 800 or 200 megawatts from these is it megawatt seabed projects? Or if that's not correct, I'd like to understand better what this is and what the implications of this are on the utilities.
Mr. Ailey, were you going to respond?
Well, I can certainly. It's been the projects that I've been involved with have been in the MISO queue since 2003. And, many of the utilities are building projects out in the Dakotas. And I would think that the state of Minnesota, if they've got an RPS, that rather than support so much economic development activity in other states, then perhaps maybe it would, since Minnesota ratepayers are paying, for renewable energy, maybe a significant share of that should be built within the state of Minnesota to provide for economic development here. I've heard comments, about from utility lobbyists that this is going to create millionaires and, stuff like that. And I think I actually think if it does, it probably maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing because those dollars end up getting spent in the state of Minnesota. I know of a developer that started, with small wind. He didn't have two nickels to rub together when he first started out. And he was successful in bringing in Suslin. And Suslin probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for REPI and Seabed. And, there are a couple hundred people that are employed down in Pipestone. And I can go on a couple different examples. I think a priority should be for Seabed in.
Senator Sharon.
There are probably two different questions, whether or not it's a good idea at all, whether or not it's good public policy to put one group of energy producers ahead of another in terms of the purchasing. I'm just trying to understand what it does, not whether or not I agree with it or not. I'm just trying to be clear how this would play out. So you build a 5-megawatt, and a utility wants to construct new generation or purchase output. What happens? In plain English, what happens?
Well, I don't know exactly what in plain English, but I know Otter Tail. I know.
It's got to be pretty simple.
I know that Otter Tail had an integrated resource plan, and they filled it with predominantly with projects built out in the Dakotas, and they, in spite of you know, sending out requests for proposals for seabed, didn't do any seabed. And
the old language asks that it be done in good faith. In good faith, there is a discussion in the old bill, is that correct, about purchasing seabed energy. And this changes this. So it requires the utilities to purchase up to 800 megawatts, is that correct, megawatts of seabed projects that are Minnesota-grown projects before purchasing power from other sources. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator, I think that's correct. No. Oh, I guess that's out of the bill.
It was not in the amendment, Madam Chair.
I thought I was. Which
does it? Does it, however, require that they purchase the seabed before, let's say, they need a peaking plant or something?
Madam Chairman, no.
It does not.
It does not require them to do anything before seabed.
Well, it's being suggested that it might.
In here.
Madam Chair, we're talking about Subdivision 5, Senator Sheeran?
Looking at Subdivision 5, priority for seabed projects, and then if you turn to page 2, in sentences 2.1 through 2.15 is speaking to this. A question that I'm trying to get my arms around, or get my head around, is... And it says the aggregate capacity projects installed for which contracts have been signed in the state reaches 800 megawatts, and then later talks about have been signed in the state reaches 200 megawatts for contracts in aggregate capacity. Again, it's I do not understand sequentially how this, what is happening here and what we're asking the utilities to do before they purchase power from some other source.
Mr. Joe?
Madam Chairman, Senator Sheeran, that provision does not say that they have to buy it before anything else. It just says that we'd like to see that 800 megawatts of seabed get built in Minnesota at some time or another over the life of this RES, the renewable energy standard that we have. But it doesn't say that they have to build that before they do anything else.
It says that it must be by December 31st of 2011, right?
That's for the 200, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, that's mainly for the 200 megawatts, but they can do anything else that they want before.
Okay.
They can build peakers or whatever.
Let's move on to the speakers, give you a break.
Thank you.
We may invite you back up later. The first speaker is Mike Manderscheid, Mayor of Woodstock.
Madam Chair, Senate Committee.
Mayor.
I am testifying in favor of Senate File Number 399 today. Let me introduce myself. I am Mike Manderscheid, Mayor of the City of Woodstock. We are a city located in southwest Minnesota along the Buffalo Ridge. Our town population is about 125 people, and we as a small town in rural Minnesota are limited to our revenue possibilities. We have a grain elevator, a bar and grill, and a treatment center in our town. As you are aware, southwest Minnesota is prime wind and home to many wind turbines. We as a city council wondered why couldn't we as a small town surrounded by turbines and transmission lines put up our own tower. With the help of Dan Jewell in 2004, we got the ball rolling. We sent a contract to XL Energy in hope of reaching a PPA, and excitingly we kept in touch with Dan and hoping to hear something, but the days went by and pretty soon it was months and then years. Finally, last winter, Dan had got a hold of me and it sounds like we're gonna get a PPA. Dan had run some rough numbers for us, and the net of a 1 megawatt project would net us around 10 to 15% of our budget the first 10 years. After the Minnesota flip, it would net us around 70 to 75% of our city's budget. With the grants that are now out there, these numbers could improve dramatically. What a great thing, renewable energy being produced and the revenue generated put back into this community. In turn, the city hiring local contractors and purchasing supplies to fix streets and other city problems. What a great stimulus for a small town. I hope in the future it can become easier for small communities, small landowners, farmers, to harness our wind revenue and keep it in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Mayor. Randy Knott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Randy Knott. I live in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, in the far northwest corner of the state. I work for a civil engineering firm doing surveying and designing flood damage reduction projects in the Red River Valley. I'm a partner in a small LLC from Thief River Falls trying to get a seabed project started. After our developer had an initial contact with the local utility representative and had a conversation about what area our price should be in order to bring an acceptable project to the table, we located a site with good wind capacity that directly adjoined existing transmission lines that had the capacity to take the energy that we produced. Land leases with farmers were signed. Everything looked good. Our feasibility study was completed, confirming the fact that, yes, we thought we had a site with good wind capacity. After our initial power purchase agreement was drafted, we approached the representative for the utilities. He set the tone for the meeting with the opening statement, "We don't need your power." He listened to our proposal, stated that he thought that it was a fair thing for the community. He would have the opportunity for their local board to push for the utilities in our behalf. But in the end, after a fair amount of time, we got our rejection letter, basically. Though our rate is comparable and competitive over the life of the project with the large companies that they're used to dealing with, the rate that day is definitely higher than Florida Power and Light's, so it gives them the opportunity to dismiss us. After a short amount of time, we decided, well, we have a problem with this utility, but maybe they're not all. We had heard that Otter Tail Power was much better to deal with, reaching basically an impasse with the current project. One of the other members and I looked at possibly doing a smaller project, basically a 5-megawatt project, limited by the line capacity in the area, which was about 20 miles away in my hometown. And we are currently in the progress of talking to landowners and getting them on board, going through the land lease program, starting all over with the hopes that they are indeed better to work with. As the economy is tightening in our rural economy, I've seen the people placing a new value on our local goods and businesses. Everyone is trying to shop locally and keep the dollars in the small towns. And the statement's been made more and more, which we never used to hear, that they look for a Made in USA sticker to give it more value to keep the money there. Supporting this bill keeps those dollars local, both in Minnesota and the United States. Right now, I believe North Dakota is definitely appreciating the increased taxes that they are generating from our power sales or our power consumption. And I'd really like to see some of that stay in Minnesota, in our state. It would make our budget a little bit better than it is today. Speaking to the long-term effects and benefits of placing projects like these in the community, we have the opportunity to add income for the farmers that own the land, making them more stable, and adding an income stream to the young farmer considering taking over the family farm. I grew up milking cows, working on our family farm, and I know that during the last recession when I was growing up, it would have made a huge difference for our family to be able to bank on having just a few thousand dollars of guaranteed income that wasn't tied to if we got the right amount of rain at the right time, which we didn't. The rate increases that are advertised in the December newspaper publication of our regional co-op for the next 3 years by Minn Kota are 13% for this year, 7% for next year, and 8% for 2011. So we know how quickly that scale is climbing. That leads to part of our frustration of knowing that we've got a stable rate that is going to actually drop 10 years from now and yet being rejected. Each time I send in my electric bill, I'm helping to pay for 35 miles of transmission lines and two substations that Minn Kota and Otter Tail Power built and upgraded to help accommodate the Florida Power and Light project in Langdon. When we asked the utility representative about the fairness of the ratepayers picking up the tab for these upgrades instead of Florida Power and Light, he explained that the cost is spread out among all the customers and that its actual rate that we would see was only about 0.003 of a cent per kilowatt hour, and that's an extremely small price. We're taking the same approach with this bill, but facing continued criticism from the same utilities that are doing that right now. Much debate has taken place over what I see as the short-term cost imbalances of the community wind. And I know we're not done yet. My thought is this. Year 10, the rates drop, and we, as the local people, see a benefit. But I'm an optimist because I want to be a part of this. Year 21, when our 20-year contract is done, we've got the infrastructure in the ground. We can look at this and say, now we can really be competitive. The benefit is to everyone, not just me. It's to everybody who sends in an electricity bill. And that's huge. We've got the option, long term, to keep this going. We'll have a good working relationship with the turbine manufacturers. We'll know them. We will have repowered several of these turbines before we reach the end of the project. That's the nature of the business. It's no different than farm machinery. An article in the 2008 October issue of Public Power magazine forecasts that some form of carbon regulation is almost certain by 2012. Our premium that we are paying is going to be either be completely diminished or totally disappear when a value is placed on the green tag credits that we have. The utilities give no value to that green tag today, but yet they're not willing to let us keep them. So there's definitely something up there also. If the implementation of cap and trade that is being discussed by President Obama comes forth, knowing that our state's power is mainly generated by burning coal when inactive, will deliver a crushing blow to our rural economy. What happens to rural Minnesota when our monthly electric bill doubles? The utilities will oppose this legislation that oppose this legislation today will pass those rate increases on to us, the ratepayer, and say, well, there's nothing we could do. But I think we need to get these projects going now. We need to get them in the ground. So when this plan is finally enacted, we have a larger percentage of renewable power that is positively affected by cap and trade instead of negatively affected.
Mr. Cannott, I'm going to ask you to wrap up now.
I am almost done. Okay. I want to go on record today as saying that we're here trying to work with the utilities and trying to reach a good common sense agreement. And so far, I feel we're being rejected. And when the public is outraged with the rate increases and their lack of effort to prevent this and see this coming, I want it known that we really tried to lessen that blow. We tried to keep the electrical generation locally owned and competitive.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Knott, so what in the A2 amendment, I hear that, of course, you're in favor of CBED and you're in favor of the standardization process. But what else in the A2 amendment that you have problems with the utilities? I'm just trying to figure out.
Well,
Mr. Knott.
Mrs. Chair.
Yeah.
Senator Rosen.
Okay, so maybe an app must buy.
We are hopeful that we can get a standardized contract template that will help us to get a PPA. That is what I'm focusing on, because that is where we have reached a brick wall. But if this comes to pass, it will definitely help us to get our project to move forward, because we will have a 5-megawatt project that we can take advantage of this legislation.
Senator Sharon.
Did I hear you correctly to say that in your experience in trying to get a project up and running, you ran into a kind of a brick wall when you wanted to establish a contract for the sale of your energy to a company because they didn't need it, or they could purchase it someplace else? So that's the crux of the thing for you, that you have to find another utility company that might be able to purchase your power. And so a way that the utility is in a way blocking, whether it's their intent or not, the expansion of these seabed projects is that they simply are not in good, whether it's in good faith or not, they're not establishing these purchase agreements with your project, even though it's right there, right by a transmission line.
Yes.
And that's what stops the progress of your project, not turbines or not other kinds of things, but the purchase agreement is not forwarded.
Mr. Knott.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. That is where we are at with our initial group. We have reached a point where we have been basically told thank you, but no thank you. And we have not been able to get past that to worry about our turbine availability. Our developer has said that that is not a problem.
I see. Because then in terms of this, excuse
Senator
me,
Sharon.
In terms of this bill then, the issue of the tariff or the issue of the the standardization of the contract. Setting that aside, I keep looking at this issue that you're raised is the attempt to force the utilities to purchase these first bunch of energy. The solution that this bill is trying to create to your problem. And of course, my follow-up question would be: is it the only solution? Is there another way for us to be able to find a way to strengthen the responsibility of utilities to purchase agreements or whatever they're called, PPAs.
Mr. Knott, do you have another
Madam
suggestion,
Chair.
Or Senator Coobley?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, it does seem to me that there is another way, and we've used it in Minnesota in the past, but I think getting REPI dollars in today's with the constraints that we have on the budget here in the state today, you know, REPI dollars are not going to be available in a time frame that would allow them to take advantage of the federal stimulus that might get these projects up and running in a timely fashion.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Can I follow up on that? And maybe, Mr. Knott, I don't know if you know, if there was a payment available to buy down the price, as Senator Kubley's talking about, a REPI payment that would buy down the price, do you think that would get you to get your PPA? Is it really just a matter of price, or is it something different, do you think?
Mr. Knott.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I don't know the dollars well enough to be able to answer that right up front, but I do believe that yes, it would make our project. If there were, obviously, if we were given money, we could lower our rate, and we could come to terms, hopefully, with the utility. That yes would be a great answer that I've been looking for.
So, are the production tax credits helpful, or the stimulus money?
I believe they would be. I have not been up to date. Two kids and a full-time job. I am not okay. Following everything that's happening on a daily basis.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knott, I assume that the utility that you're dealing with is going to buy, they're covered by the Renewable Energy Standard. They're going to be buying wind from somebody. But I presume they're going to buy it from some large developer from somewhere else instead of you, and that's kind of what you're up against.
That is the history so far, yes.
Okay. Bob Olson?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Bob Olson. I am a tax corporate attorney downtown Minneapolis. I'm the majority owner and chairman of St. Stephen State Bank in St. Cloud. We've got a branch in St. Cloud and in St. Stephen. I am also a member of the Independent Community Bankers Association of Minnesota. We have endorsed the passage of this bill. Happy to have Dave Skilbred here with us as our representative to the legislature. We think this is good for Minnesota. We think it is good for communities. I'm a boring tax lawyer and a banker, so if you want to talk about technical boring stuff, I'll answer your questions. But that's not what I want to do right now. What I think is important, and ever since I started doing the numbers about 5 years ago, is that Minnesota develop its wind resources and develop the wind resources in such a way that Minnesotans own it. A friend of mine wrote a paper entitled Who Shall Own the Wind? He said, will Minnesota develop its wind resources much like land ownership and the ownership of land occurred under Abraham Lincoln's Homestead Act, where the people who worked the land, lived on the land, owned the land? Or will Minnesota do like it did with its mining resources and its timber resources and sell it off at nickels on the dollar to Eastern establishments, where the Minnesotans worked the mines, cut the timber for minimum wage? And you people in this room have the power to affect that. Right now, I've done the numbers, I know the laws. The scales are stacked far in favor of ownership by out-of-state entities and Wall Street. We need to change that if we want to keep the money here in Minnesota. Each time, and I'll be done here in just a second, each time you look at one of those larger wind turbines out there, each one of them will supply, on average, the state-of-the-art electricity to a town of 2,000 people. They spin off annually $300,000 to $500,000 cash. Right now, you go out there and look at most of them in our communities, and 80-85% of that cash is going out of state. It's just the way it is. $400,000, $350,000 is not staying in the community. By way of anecdote, I stopped by Dexter, Minnesota, where 100 or so turbines are going up. Stopped in the restaurant there. The waitress said, yeah, it's good for business. Meantime, all of that cash, hundreds of millions of dollars over the next couple decades, will be going out of Minnesota because that project is not owned by Minnesotans. And this bill will go a long way, and we need to causing Minnesotans to own the land. I think Minnesota land is valuable for a couple of reasons. One, you can put seeds in the ground, and plants grow out of it, and you can sell the plants. And right now, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an acre makes land worth $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an acre. But Minnesota land, for the most part, is more valuable because you can put wind turbines in there and sell the electricity that the wind produces. And right now, we're giving it away. And you people in this room have the power to help balance the legal scales so that Minnesotans can own the wind. One more point. I was in San Diego a week before last, three-day conference on wind financing. Almost all of the people there were from Wall Street. And I think I'm an advocate for world interconnected economically. But day after day, 3 days, panels of the experts, I started keeping track. This is on American-owned wind. 40%, a little bit more than 40%, had European accents. Now, that's okay with me. But, on the other hand, it's up to you, people in this room, as to whether 10, 15, 20 years from now, our rural communities are sitting there with all of the value of that wind being passed to Wall Street to Europe, other areas of the world. So I would on behalf of the bankers and also personally recommend passage of this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Ann Morris?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Morse. I work for Winona County as its sustainability coordinator, and I also serve on the Winona County Economic Development Authority. I think our project might be on your list. I didn't have a chance to pick up the list, but we have a 2-megawatt project in northern part of the county that we've been working on since 2005. We were lucky to get the state's community wind rebate of $200,000 to do our project. We engaged the community broadly in a lot of enthusiasm, and we gave it our and we felt like it would be a good thing for local government to move forward. We committed to investing any future dollars that we get from our turbines to more renewable energy investment. And we moved forward, and we felt like if a local government could do this as well, we could somewhat demystify the process, because I think we heard earlier that some things are tightly held, and we recognized that, and we wanted to make it easy for people to understand how to develop wind and if it's feasible in their communities. So I know that in 2007 we came here in front of Senator Anderson's committee because we went through a number of steps that ground that had to be turned over because counties at that point had no authority to generate electricity, and we worked through those problems, and we've been working through a number of problems and rather successfully, and we are very hopeful that we will still get those turbines in the ground this fall yet. But I speak in favor of this legislation because, in fact, getting the PPA for this project was very challenging, and I say that because it's a 2-megawatt project. It's small, and it was very difficult for us to make our timeline work for the utility's timeline. So sometimes we get a phone call from the attorney working with Xcel saying, "Well, we can give you that price, but it's, you know, you have to have a commitment within a matter of weeks." And if you know anything, you know the gears of government grind slowly, and counties can't turn make those decisions quite so quickly. So it took we were not able ourselves individually to actually negotiate a power purchase agreement that was capable of making this project work, and we actually had to bring someone else who is much more familiar with the details and much better negotiator. And I would say that for small projects like ours, this would be a great help because I fully believe that our project would be in the ground today if we didn't take so long to have to try to work through that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Quick question. I'm sorry I didn't hear when you started the project. How long has it been since you started it till today?
Well, we met 4 years ago and committed to trying to work through this. We got the state grant at the end of 2005.
Okay. Thank you.
And then we got some CREB bonds, trying to figure out how best to finance it. So when this project goes in the ground, we'll be a real resource for people. I'm convinced.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Morris, so I'm just trying to understand your testimony that basically besides the standardized seabed contract language in the bill, is there anything else in the A2 amendment that you are strongly in favor of that would have helped your project?
Yes, it would not require us to try to negotiate a power purchase agreement that could cash flow the project. It would give us that standard rate, which would just be a great benefit for small projects.
Okay, thank you.
Senator
Anderson.
So the bill, the bill requires the utilities to buy the small projects up to 200 megawatts, I think, if I'm reading this right. But it also requires that for small projects the standard rate,
right,
that would go, you know, that would be front-loaded and would be a little bit more in the beginning and less in the end. So do you are both of those important for your project, do you think? Or I mean, I don't know if you...
You know, when we put our project together, I think we did our homework, and we actually found a location on some distribution lines so that we didn't have to go through the MISO queue. We did the engineering study. The small town of Altura could take the electricity generated. So the first element is not key for us. The latter one is, which is the price.
Thank you for your testimony. The next speakers are Mike Bull and Betsy Engelking. Welcome.
Thank you, Senators. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Bull. I'm the Regional Policy Manager for a group called Wind on the Wires. Wind on the Wires is a program of the Isaac Walton League, and we're a collaboration of the wind industry and a number of clean energy advocates in the Midwest, the Isaac Walton League, Fresh Energy, Environmental Law and Policy Center, Renew Wisconsin, and a number of others. And our board is split roughly 50-50 between wind industry members and clean energy advocate members. Our group, in general, we are agnostic as to ownership of wind projects. We have members that are community developers and those who provide turbine and equity to community projects and other types of projects as well. So we represent the industry broadly and push for projects and policies that will support wind development in the Midwest. From the Dakotas to Ohio, that's our footprint. Even though Wind on the Wires, as a general rule, is agnostic on ownership, I've long been a supporter of community energy. And before I came to Wind on the Wires, I have testified to this committee a number of times as the deputy director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security, where I oversaw and helped create a number of the programs that we have in Minnesota to support community energy, including working with Dan Jewell and a number of others to create the seabed program. So to a large extent, this is my fault. We want seabed to succeed. We want community energy to be part of this market. We think that's important. Senator Kubley has made a number of significant modifications to original proposal to reduce ratepayer impacts and eliminate impacts on larger seabed projects. And I think that shows that he and the proponents of the bill they want to work with others and address concerns as they're raised. And we really appreciate that willingness to work with us. Unfortunately, my father would tell me when I was a kid, and it used to confuse the crap out of me. He used to say, the important thing is to always remember the important thing. And in this case, the important thing to us, to Wind on the Wires, the Isaac Walton League, Fresh Energy, who we're speaking for today, is the state's renewable energy standard. And we have serious concerns that the bill, as it is currently, even as it's amended in its current form, will have unintended but fairly significant conflicts with the renewable energy standard and could delay compliance with the standard by a number of years. And that, to us, is a serious concern. And we would not be able to recommend to you if I understand the bill is not up to for a vote today, but we would not be able to recommend passage to you. There are a number of reasons for this, and I can go through them fairly quickly, Madam Chair. First off, Senator Sharon, you raised the issue about when the 800 megawatts would have to be brought online, and how and who and in what order and before everything else or not. And that's simply not clear in the bill. And we think that that confusion will cause significant delay. As a result, investments in other renewable energy development within the state and outside the state to serve Minnesota will dry up. and we think that will cause the potential delay. Also, you haven't heard much about this yet today, but there are significant concerns about the constitutionality of the carve-out for seabed for Minnesota-based renewable energy projects owned by Minnesotans for the benefit of Minnesotans and requiring that the output of those projects be purchased by Minnesota utilities. That's an interstate commerce question and is a significant one. There's also another federal preemption issue with regard to the Federal Public Utilities Regulatory Practices Act of 1974 or something, PURPA, that requires directs states, prohibits states from requiring utilities to buy power at rates above avoided cost. And this bill requires rates significantly above avoided cost. Those issues would, regardless of how that is resolved, those issues would have to be litigated and again cause significant confusion and delay with the state's renewable energy standard. Also, the seabed definitions and the program itself, and Madam Chair, you were getting at this with a number of your questions to Deputy Commissioner Glahn, that is simply too fuzzy and too loose to be able to be implemented in this mandated program. Currently, under current law, the seabed obligation, it's a loose obligation on the part of utilities to look for seabed projects and find those that meet their needs. It's a loose set of definitions. The requirement in the statute is that 51% of the power purchase revenues must go to qualifying owners or other local entities. And there's simply no definition in the statute as to what other local entities means. In the current program, with its looseness and flexibility, that's seen as a positive in that it allows a lot of flexibility in the system so that different types of projects can come forward. But in a mandated world, that would be terribly problematic. And without making that more clear, either the Office of Energy Security or the Public Utilities Commission would have to do a rulemaking. And again, in order to provide that clarity, and again, would set back, this program for a number of years. Finally, if any one utility ends up with too much of this, a number of these 200 megawatt projects, because it's not clear in the legislation how either the 800 or the 200 gets allocated across to the utilities, any one utility could end up with much more than, quote, its fair share of those. And so the premium rate for these 200 megawatt projects, which, as Ms. Engelking will tell you soon, is significantly above the market rate, even for seabed projects, that will likely cause it makes it much more likely that a utility will want to use the cost off-ramps that we built into the RES in 2007, which we all remember it was intended as a last resort, and this would make it much more likely that a utility could come to the commission and ask for suspension or modification or reduction of their renewable energy standard, and we think that's a significant problem.
I must say I've never heard you speak so directly. I understood everything.
Madam Chair, I'm a lot smarter too now that I'm not I don't have to deal with that Garvey fellow.
Madam Chair, I do have to say I have to hold Mr. Bull fully responsible for where we're in this pickle we're in right now. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I hold myself fully responsible for this pickle. But that's the bad news. The good news is that seabed actually, as a program in its current form, is beginning to work. We had, from 2007 to 2005 to 2007, we had one project go in place, a 2.5 megawatt seabed project. Minnesota Power bought bought the power from it, and John Ely was the developer, 2.5 megawatts. Now we have on the order of 120 megawatts in place that went installed over this past year. So 25% of all the wind that was installed in Minnesota last year was seabed. And so the utilities and the developers are starting to work through some of these problems. The federal changes to the federal incentives that Mr. Jewell talked about will also make it much easier for community projects in the future. And I think that we're going to see these things come to fruition. Two quick final points. I think it's important for everybody to remember, and you'll hear some more about this with other folks coming to the table, but every renewable energy investment for the benefit of Minnesota, seabed or otherwise, provides benefits for Minnesota ratepayers and Minnesota consumers. There are jobs associated with each of them, tax base, money in the pockets of landowners, low-cost renewable energy benefits. And so we want community energy to be part of the mix, and it needs to be, but it, no one should discount the benefits of these other types of investments as well. Finally, the biggest hurdle to seabed development, like wind energy generally, and this goes back to some of the core mission of Wind on the Wires, is transmission capacity. That all projects, regardless of size, for the most part, are being held back by the lack of transmission capacity in the system, and we're working very hard to overcome that. Madam Chair, you have a bill that's on the agenda. It doesn't seem like we might get to it today, but I think that that would be helpful in terms of keeping the legislature apprised of all those activities to move us forward on transmission capacity.
Okay, thank you. I know, Senator Coopley, I heard you say that you'd like to lay your bill over for further work. It's obvious that there are some things that need to be addressed in it. There are some members that are needing to leave, and I hate to insist they stay if there's going to be a vote, but I'd also, and I'd like to encourage people to stay for the rest of the speakers. But at the same time, there are some people that would like to leave. And can you address?
Well, yes, Madam Chair. Well, as we spoke yesterday, I know we had talked about, laying the bill over with the possible exception of the standardized contract piece. But, you know, whatever the will of the committee is, I guess I would, my preference would be to lay the bill over at least the rest of the portions apart from the standardized contract, and work on those in the immediate future if we can do that. I'd still like to move the bill forward this session, Madam Chair, but, you know, I think, you know, if we could get some of the stakeholders together fairly quickly.
Senator Coopley, there are still a number of questions about the standard contract. But,
all right.
I would like to lay over the bill, and we'd like to get some people together to work out some of the details. Okay.
That'd be fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there questions of Mr. Bull? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions. I guess I won't give you a hard time for being the architect of the 800 megawatts. I think that was your idea. But you've already admitted all that. And but just a couple questions or sort of comments. One is about the issue of whether we can require the utilities to buy from Minnesota producers and whether that's a constitutional issue. I'm wondering if we just dropped it, and as the author of Seabed, I'll do my, well, whatever. I was just going to suggest maybe if we just made it 5 megawatts that they would the utilities would have to buy and just skip
Senator,
the reference to seabed. If we didn't say it had to be meet the seabed criteria.
Senator Anderson, could you do this outside of the committee?
Oh.
Would you mind?
We don't have time for questions? Or?
No, you do have some.
Okay, the question is, if we just said 5 megawatts, under 5 megawatts, utilities have to buy it, could we avoid that problem? And as long as we didn't tie it to that seabed definition. One question, and then the other question is about the transmission. It seems to me that a lot of these small projects, the 5 megawatts are under what I'm really focusing on. The advantage that they have is that they either don't need new transmission or they're located. There was one gentleman who talked about having access to transmission. And so it seems to me if we limited this bill to those kinds of projects, you're actually offering an advantage to utilities trying to meet the RES that they could do it without new transmission in some cases.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, on your first question, that's my understanding. If you remove the requirement that it be located in Minnesota, owned by Minnesotans, that then you're moving yourself away from the interstate commerce question. But I would leave that to Mr. Fuller and yourself, who are both practicing attorneys, as opposed to myself, which just has a law degree. The second question, there was a recent study ordered by this legislature and done by the Department of Commerce, this dispersed generation, renewable generation study, and it found that there are sweet spots in the system, but that there are still significant impacts of dispersed generation on the high voltage transmission system. So that there are a few sweet spots around, that there are still impacts on that even dispersed generation has impacts on the high voltage transmission system, and the need for, and it supported, in our view, the need for additional transmission capacity. So the answer to your question is yes. It wasn't a yes or no question. I'm sorry.
And Madam Chair, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I know there is a legal opinion being sought by the supporters of this bill on the preemption agreement that Mr. Bull is talking about.
Okay. Ms. Engelking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're short on time, and I think that, as all of your questions have shown this afternoon, that there's a lot in this bill, and there's an awful lot I can say, and at some points I'm just sort of grasping at what should I say as we move forward, because I do have a lot of information. First off, I do have a handout for you on cost, so if somebody would be able to pass that around, I would appreciate it. I want to start... Maybe I'll start with the easiest piece of this, which is the standard contract piece. First, I didn't identify myself for the record. My name is Betsy Engelking. I am Director of Resource Planning and Acquisition for Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy supports the development of standard contracts. We do believe, particularly for smaller projects, that we should be able to come up with standard contracts that will significantly shorten the amount of time that would take to get a project from, you know, having a proposal accepted to getting a signed contract and being able to, you know, start putting shovels in the ground. But I don't think that we should fool ourselves that this is something that happens really fast. And so the one comment that I'm going to make on your standard contract provision is that the time frame that you're allowing for the commission to implement standard contracts is way shorter than the time they take to do almost anything. So I would be doing my former colleagues at the commission a disservice to suggest that they could actually start a proceeding and get an order out on standard contracts in 90 days. It's going to be a very complex issue that is going to require, you know, setting some issues and compromises. So I wanted to start with that piece. I felt like as I listened to people talk about this, you know, the best thing that I could start with here is a couple of anecdotes. And the first one, actually, I came by completely outside of my work in utility resource planning, and that is that my husband's colleague just inherited his parents' farm in southwest Minnesota, and it just happens that this farm has three wind turbines on it that are part of a project, which we contract for. And he was asking his colleague about these turbines that are part of a seabed project, a larger seabed project, and said, well, you know, what was your investment in these? And, you know, first was talking about what, you know, how much are you, you know, how much money do you make off of these turbines? And, you know, it was, you know, fairly reasonable for farm income. It was about $4,000 to $5,000 a turbine per year. And he said, well, what was your investment in this project? How did you become an owner of this project? His investment was $75 a turbine. Now, this is on a project that costs tens of millions of dollars. And he became a qualified owner by investing $75. And the rest of that ownership is going to, right now, out-of-state equity providers who are the ones who will probably get a lot of the benefits that are being conferred by this bill. My second anecdote, I think it came actually just this morning. a colleague of mine actually talked with a developer who's developed a number of wind projects for us over the past several years and is currently working with us on a 20-megawatt project that is seabed qualified and that he's willing to sell us for about 6.5 cents, you know, with all these different front-loaded contract things and everything. But overall, the cost of the project will cost us about 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour for the next 20 years. And what he said when he was talking about this bill coming up is he goes, well, if this bill passes, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to stop negotiating with you on this contract. I'm going to split it up into four projects. I'm going to find four different qualifying owners for it, and I'm going to charge you over 10 cents a kilowatt hour for it. That is one of the direct impacts that I heard just this morning about passing this bill. So I think that's probably a good place to start, is to just say, you know, please be aware of what this bill is doing. You know, we believe that the pricing, the premium pricing for under 5-megawatt projects, not only is not necessary to attract seabed projects, but it's also not necessary to attract small seabed projects. The example that I put in front of you is actually a real pricing example for a contract that we signed 3 months ago with a 4.5-megawatt seabed project. The red gives you the pricing that we actually agreed to pay for the project. The levelized cost that we're paying, again, is 6.5 cents, which seems to be something near the going rate for seabed. If we were to adopt the pricing mechanism that is being proposed in this bill, the price that we would have to pay for this project would be a levelized cost of about $9.34 a kilowatt hour. It's fully 3 cents a kilowatt hour more than what we're actually paying for this project. The question is, if this particular developer believed that he could develop this project and recover all of his costs and a reasonable return on his investment for 6.5 cents, why is this bill telling us that we need to pay 9 cents? You know, I don't think that we're coming up here and disputing that we want to keep wind dollars in Minnesota. We're not even disputing that the community projects, you know, with some of their structures do actually leave more money in the community, although I don't think that it's as dramatic as the pie chart that many of you might have seen where there's, you know, for out-of-state projects, there's this little sliver that comes to Minnesota and everything else leaves because, you know, we do know that we use local contractors and many other local things to build those out-of-state projects. But I think the reality here is, why should we pay more for the same benefits that we can get by paying less? And if we're getting more benefits for these under 5-megawatt projects, what are they? How are they different from the benefits that we get from normal seabed? I also wanted to talk just first a little bit about our recent seabed results. I appeared before you a few weeks ago talking about what we have in the ground. But since I appeared from before you before, we have actually gotten the results of our most recent seabed bid. And it was really sort of beyond our belief. We actually received proposals for 45 separate seabed projects totaling more than 2,275 megawatts. All of those were priced at a levelized price between roughly 6.5 and 7.5 cents. I think there's probably a few outliers in there. Now, these were not under 5-megawatt projects, and I will point that out. They are the smallest was 18, the largest was 150 megawatts. But we haven't actually heard that small projects give us any better seabed benefits than large projects. And in fact, if small projects give us benefits to a community, you know, wouldn't a 20-megawatt project give us four times the benefit of a small project? You know, wouldn't we rather see 20-megawatt projects go in that qualify? And we can do it at a lower cost than this bill. The second thing I'd like to address is the pricing mechanism. Everybody is going to get up here and tell you that this is a market-based price, or the proponents will get up and tell you it's a market-based price. It's really easy for them to do it because they're going to point to the bill and they're going to say it says market right here. It says market. So I've been trying to think of ways to explain this pricing mechanism to you and why it is not a market-based price or related to a market-based price. And it's sort of like explaining that a nacho cheese Dorito is related to corn, because you have to fold, spindle, and mutilate this price to get from last year's MISO price. So I decided that the easiest way to do it would be just to lay out the steps you have to go to get from last year's MISO average market price at the Minnesota Hub to get to the price that they want to pay wind generators under this bill. The first thing you do is you take last year's MISO market price. You multiply it by the total production of the project over the 20-year life of the project. Using that number, you're going to calculate an annual annuity that would be paid for the next 20 years if you invested those dollars, the dollars from multiplying the market price times the total production, today at a particular discount rate. Ours happens to be about 7.4%. Okay, once you get that, you get what's called a levelized annual price. Okay, then you're going to adjust that price so that you raise the first 10 years and you lower the last 10 years, and there's no mathematical calculation. It's an art more than a science. You just have to raise one up and lower one until you sort of get something that approximates the same cost as that levelized price. And then you take it and you divide it by the annual production of the project, and that gives you the price that needs to be paid for projects under this law. Now, I think you can see by the little handout that I handed out that if we assume last year's MISO market price at the Minnesota Hub, which was $48 a megawatt hour, and we go through all of these jurisdictions and I apply my art because somebody else might come out with a different number, we actually get a price that says I'm going to pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour in the first 10 years of this contract and 8 cents in the second 10 years of this contract. Now, and that's what I'm going to pay today. And today, or for this year, we expect the MISO average market price to be somewhere around where last year's was, somewhere around $48 a megawatt hour. So this price is a premium price. The only thing that the MISO market price does is it establishes the cap for the net present value rate. There are a lot of different ways you can do that. When you originally passed the seabed legislation, you actually set the cap in legislation. You set it at 2.7 cents. And after a few years, we decided that didn't work because the costs of wind were going up and there were a lot of projects that couldn't make it under the cap. And so we took the cap out because we really felt like a competitive process was a better way to get those seabed projects in the door. And I think we've used that competitive process. Finally, the issue I want to address is that this bill does not do hardly anything to clear up or remove the barriers that we're really seeing to seabed, barriers like transmission interconnection, turbine availability, financing availability, the ability of developers to actually develop projects. I mean, we get a lot of proposals from people who would dearly love to develop a wind turbine, but they really don't have the wherewithal, the ability, the acumen, you know, the knowledge to really develop a project. And so, I mean, it's not as simple as just throwing up a wind turbine in your backyard. You know, and so I think that that's something that people need to understand. And I think that, you know, one of the most telling things is when you heard from Ms. Morse from Winona on how she's been working on 4 years on her project and we hit this barrier and we hit that barrier and there was this timing and that timing, there was one thing that she didn't mention at all, and that was price. We have gone, I think, to very good extremes to accommodate the pricing needs and the timing needs of our seabed developers. We have had signed contracts for seabed where we have gone back to the Minnesota PUC three times for pricing amendments to raise the price because certain barriers have prevented them from getting their projects in, or their turbine manufacturer bailed on the contract that they had promised because they could get a better price somewhere else, and so they had to pay more for turbines. We have actually gone in and adjusted prices. We've adjusted prices from bids to in order to get to contracts. We don't actually believe that price is the seabed barrier here. And we do believe that, you know, we are seeing a competitive market for seabed prices. Now, you know, we are also seeing, frankly, that, you know, we see this competitive market and everybody makes proposals. And when we actually try to sit down and, you know, we get contracts or we try to negotiate contracts, a lot of these projects can't be developed for various reasons. You know, some of them might be due to the length of contract negotiation, and that's why we're proposing standard contracts, but a lot of it isn't. And I think that we really need to explore those barriers before we explore offering premium prices or forced purchases on utilities. I'm going to end there. I certainly agree with a lot of the things that Mr. Bull said, and I'm willing to answer questions, and I'd be happy to talk with you again if we want to go back and work on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Engelking. Are there questions? It was a very clear presentation. Appreciate it. The next speakers are Deb Bergen and Earl Cummings.
Good
Ms. Bergen.
Thank you, Senator Solon, and thank you, committee members. My name is Deb Bergen. I'm manager of state legislative relations at Missouri River Energy Services, a municipal power agency. Our headquarters are in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We have 60 municipal electric utility members located in four states, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and, of course, Minnesota. 24 of our 60 members are located here in Minnesota. And I'm not only representing Missouri River Energy Services today, I'm also speaking in part on behalf of the municipal community at large. You'll also hear further testimony from Mr. Daryl Twiteback, who's also on the list, speaking for municipal communities. First of all, I'd like to say that MRS is not opposed to seabed projects. We have two seabed projects on the ground that went into commercial operation here in 2008. You've seen them on Bill Glahn's list. One is 14.7 megawatts of seabed located near Marshall, Minnesota, and 20 megawatts near Odin or St. James, if you don't know where Odin is, Minnesota. So those two started working. So in our opinion, this is something we've worked on. It took us a long time to get those projects up and running, and Jeff Peters of our office had to spend a lot of time working to find good seabed projects, but we found them, and the seabed law is working, but what we need is to let it work. We are only a couple years into it, as Bill Glahn's list showed. We just have some of the first projects in 07, more in 08. More will come online. You've heard Mr. Glahn's testimony. You've heard the testimony of Xcel Energy. More seabed projects will come online, and based on our experience, all the utilities will add, more seabed will be added to this state, but it will take longer if we're not afforded the flexibility in the current laws. When you change rules midstream, it's not only the utilities that have to adjust to the change, but the financiers, the wind developers, everyone has to adjust to those change. So when you change things just 2 years in, you have to take a long look at it. Are these adjustments helping, or is it starting everyone back to square one? And that's a concern. We understand the desire to hurry up the process and add more seabed, but we think SF-399 is the wrong framework. First of all, you've already heard Michael Bull testify. I won't go into a long diatribe, but we believe it violates the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. Second, as Mr. Bull also alluded to, we think it slows down the RES, because the way I read it, if a utility needs power for the RES, you must contract with seabed first. And if it's not available or if it's not a good project, that's going to slow down. We're a cost-based municipal power agency. All of our members are cost-based municipal electric utilities. We are constantly concerned and watching, is this the best project for our municipal members? If we have a chance to buy a wind project that is in a 34% capacity factor area, versus a wind project, although it may be seabed, but it's an area where it only has 20% capacity factor, I think it's in our members' best interest that we go with the project with the better capacity factor, even though that's not seabed. And that's something we're conscious of. We're also conscious of location. For example, if we were to build a project in South Dakota for the Minnesota RES, we may have to cross the MISO seam. That can add up to 20% on top of our costs. So location of a project is also important, and that's something we're always conscious of. We do sympathize with the smaller developers that have spoken today and their goal to increase seabed and smaller generation, but we would suggest some other alternatives than the bill before you. One which was alluded to earlier, and I believe Senator Anderson asked the question, was a seabed REPI, and we would be supportive of that. In fact, we built our first wind project ever in Worthington, Minnesota, based in part because we could get the REPI credit in Minnesota, and that made it a much more economically viable project for us. Plus, Worthington, Minnesota is one of our municipal member communities. So we're happy to find a project that was economical. We were supported by the REPI, and we were able to build that project near one of our Minnesota member municipal communities. And second, we are supporting Senator Scogin's bill, SF-1194, and I believe Senator Rosen is on that bill too, which is a small renewable energy grant bill. It gives projects an upfront grant of $2,500, or one-third of the cost, whatever is less, for small residential-level renewable projects. Now, those aren't utility-scale projects, but it's another alternative start down the line of Minnesota-based projects, Minnesota grants, Minnesota money for the smaller projects. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dahl.
A couple quick questions. Ms. Bergen, you'd mentioned you're looking for a good CBID project. That's one of the things you're doing.
We found two of them.
What qualifies, or what, in your model, what's a good CBID project?
Ms. Bergen.
Thank you. Senator Solon, Senator Dibble, a project that is got the finance affiliates ready to go. They've got the wind turbines that are going to be delivered in a timely manner, as Ms. Engelkink indicated, that fits our timing. And it's a good project in terms of if there's any transmission wheeling costs associated, as well as good capacity factor.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if
Senator
I might just
Dahl.
The other thing you were talking about, the framework in these, it sounds like you were talking about some subsidies or grants. So you would rather that we use taxpayer dollars instead of ratepayer dollars to finance these particular projects? Is that what you're
Yes, Senator Dibble, under the federal stimulus, sorry, Senator Solon, Senator Dahl, excuse me, the SF-1194 would take federal stimulus money and put that in a grant format. That's money that is already coming to the state. It's already been allocated, if you will, and that's something right now available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. The next speaker is Earl Cummings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Earl Cummings. I own a company called Turning Point Management, and I do project management, among other things, for renewable wind energy projects. With me to my right today is Neil Von Olin, who is a landowner who is involved in three projects that I have worked with, and his testimony will follow mine. I'm not here today to debate on what is or is not a good draft or form of the current bill. I think I'll leave that to the folks that deal with that stuff every day. I'd rather get down to the dirt, as they so to speak, and talk about some facts. And what I'd like to suggest is that before we go further and talk about how we finance projects and whether we have a bucket of 200 or 800 or et cetera, is to get a clear definition of what is a seabed project. There's a definition floating around that a seabed project is only a project that has local benefits, local ownership, and keeps the cash local. I'd like to challenge that today with a couple of thoughts. First of all, I share Mike Bull's reference that the number one goal with all of us, and I'm encouraged by we all have different points of view here today, and those of us that have testified or will testify, that the ultimate goal is to reach the RPS. And my goal is certainly no different than that. And the second goal is to allow locals to gain and get a fair rate of return on these projects. I certainly support that. I might mention at this point in time, just as a point of reference, that I, too, work with projects that can be called seabed or not seabed, and I'm in 5 and 6 years of developing a project just like some of these smaller ones. So it's not just the small projects that have problems getting PPAs or interconnection or permitting. I have a project in Amboy, Minnesota that we've been working on since 2004. We've been in the MISO queue for 4.5 years. It's a 49.5 megawatt project. And if I choose to come out of the queue to develop that project today, even if I had a PPA, I would have to pay an excess of $34 million for transmission upgrades. That's not going to happen. So the problems that we talk about as far as seabed, wind projects, et cetera, I think it was mentioned earlier that transmission and permitting hasn't really been discussed, and I'm here to tell you that that is a much larger problem than what seabed is or isn't and whether we got 200 or 800. It's getting the ability to transmit the power once we get to ability to be able to construct the project. Large wind does not mean no local ownership or benefits. I'd like to repeat that. large wind projects do not mean the lack of local ownership or benefits. I'm here to talk about a revenue participation model, and Mr. Von Olin will attest to that here shortly, that we've done this three times, about to do it four. Mr. Von Olin has done it twice, about to do it the third time, whereby the project involves the landowners receiving the traditional benefits that you do out of a wind project, such as lease payments for land and turbines, and in addition to that, revenue participation. Now, I have a handout here if I'd like to make sure that those of the committee receive same. It's an independent study. It was developed in 2007, and I believe this was handed out to the committee previously. And basically what it shows is that the revenue participation model will yield the same, if not greater, benefits than an ownership model. Now, we had to take certain liberties and assumptions, and we took the various assumptions that were used in the previous seabed models and that were used to develop the existing legislation of 2007. So bottom line is I'd like to just mention some facts, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Von Olin. We've heard a lot of opinions here today. I've heard some people state some facts that I'm certainly going to go back and research. Either we are dealing in two different worlds or what, but there's some things that have been stated to here today that just I just find difficult to accept. First of all, ownership does not translate as the only way for local benefits. Revenue participation in projects will yield the same, if not a better, rate of return on a net present value basis without the risk. It's been proven. We've performed two 100-megawatt projects down in Martin and Jackson County, and we are now in the process of building another 150 megawatts in Martin and Jackson County under the same business model. And I wish we could have had a busload of landowners up here today to testify to you that all they can tell you is they sleep at night, they don't have to worry about whether a gearbox goes down, they don't worry about year 21, because in year 21 they will continue to receive the benefits for the life of the project. They don't have to worry about decommissioning. They don't have to worry about making sure that the price of the PPA doesn't exceed owning and operating costs. Those are left to the people that know wind projects, not landowners that are primary businesses to plant corn, soybeans, and so on and so forth. Number two fact, revenue participation. It is good or a better alternative than ownership. The analysis that I gave you will bear that out. Number three, we are in a global economy. That is not a news revelation to anybody here, but there was a chart handed out earlier today about the seabed projects. And I can't remember who handed it out, and it's a seabeds list of 119.4 megawatts. I note with interest that less than 6% of the financing was done inside the state of Minnesota, and it's blank, so I'm just going to assume it was done in Minnesota. The rest of the projects were financed by John Deere and Edison Mission. Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, those two companies are not in Minnesota, right. But they're being claimed to be seabed projects. So it doesn't hold water, in my opinion, that just because a project is financed with people outside Minnesota, that it does not have local benefits. Fact, risk versus reward. I haven't heard that yet today. Anytime we look in business today to make an investment, we look at the risk, we look at the reward, we look at the payback. This is no different. This is absolutely no different. So if a landowner chooses not to take on the risk of ownership, then they should not be penalized because they're not a seabed project and take a second seat to a so-called seabed project. Next, fact. Local production tax. If you are a project of 2 megawatts or less versus a project that is above, or the projects that I'm familiar with, above 50 megawatts to 100 megawatts, on a per kilowatt hour basis, we pay 10 times the production tax to the local county. If the project is up to 5 megawatts, we pay 4 times the rate paid per kilowatt hour. To give you a reference point, in Martin and Jackson County, the projects that we have developed thus far are generating in excess of $350,000 to $400,000 a year in production tax monies. If you were to make those projects two megawatt projects, instead of having one 100-megawatt project and receive $350,000 to $400,000 in tax, if you had 52-megawatt projects, you would receive approximately $35,000 to $40,000 in tax. So the fact is, large wind has major economic and local benefits. I might also mention that the Morris study has been mentioned three or four times today. Forgive me, I forgot the author's name, but I have talked to him on two occasions, and I asked him where the analysis was on production tax. He said, I forgot it. I'll let that stand on its own. Next, a lack of PPAs and transmission. These are major issues of being able to meet the RPS. Now, why do we have a lack of PPAs? You have to have transmission before you can get a PPA. You've heard it testified today that PPAs are signed, and they've had to go back three or four times or a couple times to get a rate increase. The reason being is projects do not go smoothly. Anybody in this room that is involved in a project that tells you it goes smoothly has not done one. It just doesn't happen. Last but not least, after year 21 and during the years 1 through 20, the revenue participation model allows the landowners to continue to receive revenue without worrying about how they're going to repower, regen, or decommission, or what they're going to do about a new PPA, or how they're going to make sure that they retain the margins that they've enjoyed in the past. Thank you, and I'll take questions.
Mr. Olin, Mr. Cummings, what happens after the 21st year?
Madam Chair, what happens after the 21st year is that whoever owns the project, if they choose to repower the project or continue the project and re-up the PPA, the landowners will continue to receive their revenue participation along with other traditional payments for their land and the turbine rent.
And who is the owner?
In this particular case, we kind of do the reverse of an RFP. We make our projects ready, and we go out to developers and ask them who would like to do the project for us. At the moment, we have one project owned by PPM Energy, which is now Iberdrola. We have a second one owned by Iberdrola.
And where is that located?
PPM Energy and Iberdrola. PPM was located out in Portland, Oregon, and Iberdrola, I believe, has their corporate headquarters in Pennsylvania.
And so what type of revenue would the owner of the land expect to earn?
Well, typically, Madam Chair, typically the way landowners look at their income today is they look at it on a per-acre basis. And we target to get somewhere in the area of $80 to $100 per acre per year as incremental revenue to the landowner as a result of these projects. So that will come in the form of either lease for their land, turbine payments, or revenue participation.
Although that would be significantly less than the other model of ownership, right?
Madam Chair, I beg to differ with you. If you look at the piece of paper you have in your hand, you will see that the ownership model and the revenue participation model basically equate to the same rates of return for the local landowner. The difference, quite frankly, is the revenue participation starts day one. The ownership model makes the assumption that at some point in time, you have to give up the benefits, of course, on the front end for, as was testified earlier today, for the tax benefits. And then eventually the ownership could, in fact, flip to the landowner or the local persons involved in the project. But the revenue participation model continues, regardless of who owns the project.
Questions? Senator Dahl.
Question, thank you. Of the 112 megawatts, these two, of the 120, there's the two, 112 megawatts is from John Deere Wind and Edison Mission Group, or the equity investors. Of those, do you know which ones of those are the flip model and which ones are the revenue participation model, or what percentage? I guess the reason I'm asking is if we're looking at 90 to 95% of that with equity investors going back to those investors in the first 10 years, I mean, I'm just trying to get an idea of how much is actually going back out of the state, because we know that those two groups are not located in Minnesota.
Madam Chair and Senator Dole, I am not aware of what and who the flip or the ownership structure is. It's usually kept confidential.
Senator Dahl, these are all flip models. These are all seabed projects.
These are all seabed projects. Yeah,
what Mr. Cummings is talking about is not a seabed project.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may challenge that statement, I do believe we're seabed for the very reasons I define seabed as something that affords the opportunity for local benefits, as described in that letter that you have from Ide Bailey, as well as the testimony I've just given. The fact that we're not defined as seabed today, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and it flies like a duck, it probably is a duck.
Have you challenged that with the department to see if it fits the model?
Yes, we have. And they've very appropriately said, submit us the application.
And have you done that?
If I could get transmission, I would, Madam Chair.
But you have projects up and running.
We have two projects up and running, and we have a third ready to go.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple comments. This was the field trip down into my Senate district, the one that you were not able to come. There was quite a few around the table that were down there. We refer to this project as in the Jackson-Martin County area as Seabed Light, but I do believe it fits in that definition of a community benefit. There is definitely a community benefit, and I think Mr. Van Olen will speak on that.
I'm not denying that there's benefit.
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously benefit from just getting the wind up and running in Minnesota. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, but, and they'll talk about taxes and all that. But, Mr. Cummings, how much is it per year that the investors get back return? Did you mention we're all spaced out here? We forgot how much.
Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, we target to get somewhere between $80 and $100 an acre back to the landowners that participate in the project, which is a composition of the payments to landowners for putting their land in the project. We call it a nuisance payment for turbines. Some people call it a turbine fee, but quite frankly, we call it a nuisance payment for having the turbine on their land. But the largest percentage is getting a percentage of the gross revenues of the project. And I failed to mention before it was gross revenues. We don't get tied up into what is net income or what is expense in the project. It's defined as the gross revenues of the project. The landowners get a fixed percentage of that.
Roughly.
I wish I could tell you that. I'm sorry.
Well, Madam Chair.
If you look at the charts, Senator Rosen, it looks like they're equating the Trimont Farms area wind farm. They come up with identical figures, I guess, with the front-loaded tariff or the fixed tariff. Senator Coobley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. I don't think that the people who are supporting this bill are not saying that there is no benefit to the larger wind projects. They're just saying that the benefit is greater if you're looking at local ownership for local communities. One other small point in Mr. Cummings' comments, Iberdrola is a Spanish company. We don't deny that they have offices in this country, but it is a corporate entity that exists in Spain.
And Madam Chair, if I may respond to that.
Mr. Cummings.
I will challenge the fact that smaller projects bring more local benefit than larger projects, and Mr. Van Olen can speak to that. And second of all, yes, Iberdrola is a Spanish company. They employ 56 people full-time in the state at the present time and will continue to employ more as more projects are developed. They supply the financing. They are the ownership, just as John Deere supplies the financing, and they have the ownership. Just as Edison Capital from California supplies the capital, and they have the ownership. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, it's difficult to believe that when a foreign entity owns the project, supplies the capital, that they aren't taking something out of the country.
Okay. Mr. Van Olen. Van Olen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to touch a little bit today about the revenue participation and how I don't think, and the people in our LLCs think, that necessarily ownership is the only game in town. Before in testimony it was asked,
what kind of return are seabed models getting after the first couple years, and the person stated that most of the money is going to come after the flip, whereas our project, the returns come year one, and they're huge. They're phenomenal. And the reason I know this is because as a manager of the LLC, I sign the checks and mail them out. And, you know, this is stuff that went into our decision-making in the beginning. With the flip model, most of that money is going to come after year 10. When you come to our LLC meetings, you'll see the number of actual people with color or pigment in their hair can be counted on one hand. The average age would guarantee you would be over 75 in our LLC. Now, to go to a group and say, we could have ownership potentially down the road, and when you're 85 to 90, you could see great returns, that wasn't that interesting to us. And at the same time, we started thinking about it. The idea of actually owning a turbine in 14, 15 years, the question came up, how many 14 or 15-year-old computers would you like to invest in? We didn't know if we wanted to handle the responsibility of ownership, repair, maintenance. I think sometimes that's people don't consider that in ownership. I live in the middle of 133, and I see the amount of maintenance that it takes to maintain these turbines. It takes roughly one person for every 10 turbines. I've seen the project, our first project, within the first year, there was a total of 7 gearbox and generators that had to be replaced. Was it covered? Sure. But what's going to happen at year 10 when the landowner owns those turbines? Why would they want to bear that burden? So we felt we had a great project where the return is phenomenal and the risk is minimized. Earl talked a little bit about, well, basically covered how much production tax is being established right away in between the two counties. Our third project is going to be 150 megawatts, so that'll add roughly another $600,000 of production tax to the two counties. So, and our third project hopefully is up and running by the end of 2010. So between the three projects, there'll be over $1.4 million that come to the counties every year through production tax. And in discussions with Earl earlier, I kind of equated it to Senator Rosen's Martin County would be in the top five in the nation for hog production. You can travel down any road in Martin County and constantly see 12 to 16 hog barns. But yet if you were to go to each one of those farms and ask who owns the hogs that are in them, you'd find out that it's not the landowner or the building owner. It's some major conglomerate. And the reason for that being is because at the end of the day, landowners, they're faced with enough risk going forward in agriculture. Basically, since last November, corn prices have dropped in half. Input costs have shot through the roof, and the numbers are getting tighter and trickier every day. So with those hog barns that are in Mountain County, they know where they're at the end of the day. They have a steady income revenue, much like our revenue participation model in the wind farm gives us. With that, I'll end and entertain any questions.
Okay, questions? Thank you. Mr. Twightback?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Someone gets to be last, right? Members of the committee, I think it's good evening now. I have good afternoon in my text, but it looks like it's good evening in my world. My name is Darrell Twightback, and I'm the general manager of the Northern Municipal Power Agency. Our headquarters are located in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. And I'm here today to speak against the passage of SF 399. Although I have other concerns about this legislation, I'll only address one area of concern today. And I'm here today to express my concern about the potential impact that this bill could have on ours and other power agencies in Minnesota, and those are financial impacts. We recently completed a refinancing of $80 million of outstanding municipal bonds that were issued in 1998 by our agency. As part of that process, we are required to go before the credit rating agencies. On this particular bond issue, we use Moody's and Standard & Poor's. The process of obtaining a credit rating requires full disclosure of our operations to the rating agency. The regulatory environment that we operate in is part of that disclosure. This bill causes me concern, and this type of regulatory policy causes concern at Moody's. And I'd like to quote a little bit from Moody's. They provided some material for me. And this is from something called the 2009 U.S. Public Power Electric Sector Outlook, recession and climate change policies, challenge, stable outlook. Some of the bullet points. Recessionary pressures and more aggressive environmental regulation have created uncertainty and could stress credit matrix. Material business and operating risks are increasing due to increased potential for more stringent carbon regulation. New investment in infrastructure for baseload and renewable energy projects will require financing amid unsettled credit markets. Power supply decisions will be more difficult because of the uncertain impact on the reliability and costs of mandates on increasing renewable resources. And still quoting from Moody's, the U.S. electric industry has been subjected to major reforms and changes over the past several decades that sometimes had unintended consequences for the utility credit quality. For example, while the broad policy objective of industry deregulation had many positive attributes when it was first introduced in the 90s, unforeseen consequences such as widespread market speculation helped create the California energy crisis of 2000-2001, and that resulted in negative credit impacts for many public power utilities. Today's focus on renewable energy to significantly replace electric generation fired by fossil fuel and reduce carbon emissions also harbors the potential for unintended consequences. The U.S. electric industry reliability framework has not yet been developed to ensure load is adequately balanced with the introduction of more renewable energy resources such as wind and solar, which are intermittently available. Moody's will closely follow this type of potential unintended consequence and its impact on credit. Members of the committee, Senate File 399 could have unintended consequences of lowering the credit rating of our agency and others. A lowering of credit rating would not only cause substantially higher interest costs for our agency and its customers, but would could cause our bonds to be unsaleable in a very unsettled credit market and that we are operating in. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, now is not the time to require utilities to pay higher mandated prices that will in turn be passed on to our customers. And I'll thank you for your time and entertain any questions.
I thank you for your testimony and for waiting throughout all the other speakers.
My plane doesn't leave till 8:30, so.
Okay. Are there questions? Okay. That does bring us to the end of our speakers.
Thank you.
We've lost our committee for discussion. I think Senator Kubley will lay the bill over, and that will give you some time to work on.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Thank you for that time. It was a long day.
Thank you. And my bill will be held over again. We'll get to it eventually. We will meet on Tuesday. We need to be out of the room, actually, at 5 o'clock on Tuesday. So I would like members to be here on time so that we can get through our bills quickly. We have three PUC bills, and we have a telecom bill on Tuesday. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.